Garnet Linden. Big Questions for Brave Minds, My Little Philosopher. Copyright 2025 by Garnet Linden. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced, stored or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, photocopying, recording, scanning, or otherwise without written permission from the publisher. It is illegal to copy this book, post it to a website, or distribute it by any other means without permission. First edition. This book was professionally typeset on Readsy. Find out more at readsy.com. Introduction. Dear reader, some books tell you what to think. This is not one of those books. This book was made for curious hearts, young and old alike, who aren't afraid to ask the questions that don't have easy answers. Within these pages lies a journey through big ideas, told through small stories. Stories that invite children and the grown-ups lucky enough to read alongside them to explore what it means to think deeply, feel honestly, and live wisely in our wonderful, complicated world. You'll meet philosophers from across time and around the globe who spent their lives wondering about the same things you might wonder about. How should we treat each other? What makes something fair or unfair? Why are we here? What makes a good life? And how do we know what we know? But this isn't just a book about other people's thoughts. It's about discovering your own. Each chapter opens a door to critical thinking, learning to question, wonder, and see things from different angles, creative imagination, expressing your thoughts through art, words, and play, emotional wisdom, understanding that our feelings are an important part of how we make sense of life, natural connection, recognizing that we are part of something much larger than ourselves. The stories you'll find here are small, but the questions they contain are enormous. They might make you laugh, scratch your head, or feel a flutter of something new in your heart. Sometimes, they might even leave you with more questions than answers. And that's exactly as it should be. This is not a book of answers, it's a book of beginnings. Whether you're 8 or 80, these pages are meant to be explored with an open mind and a gentle heart. Read them slowly. Talk about them with someone you trust. Draw in the margins. Ask what if. And why not? If this book makes you feel something, curiosity, confusion, wonder, or even a little spark of courage, then it's doing exactly what it was meant to do. Because the world doesn't need perfect thinkers. It needs honest, open-hearted ones. With Wonder, Your Fellow Philosopher. One, the Island of One. In the middle of the Sapphire Sea sat the Evergreen Archipelago, dozens of tiny islands, each with exactly one resident. That's how it had always been. Nico, a small orange fox, lived on his own perfect island. It had a cozy den beneath an oak tree and fields of wild strawberries that tasted like sunshine. We're the luckiest creatures in the world, Headmaster Owl often reminded everyone, each with our own perfect space. No arguing, no sharing, no complicated feelings. Every morning, Nico would stretch and say, "Good morning, Island." He could do whatever he wanted. No one told him to clean his den or to stop eating strawberries for every meal. But lately, Nico had been feeling something strange, a hollow feeling in his chest that wouldn't go away. From his highest hill, he could see the other islands. There was Mira the rabbit on her carrot-covered isle and Leo the turtle, whose island moved very slowly with the currents. Sometimes Nico would wave. The others would wave back, quick, polite waves, before returning to their solitary activities. One morning, the hollow feeling was so strong that Nico couldn't even finish his breakfast. Looking out across the water, he noticed something he'd never seen before. A narrow sandbar connecting his island to Mira's during low tide. Heart pounding, Nico did something no one in Evergreen Archipelago ever did. He left his island. When he reached Mira's island, the small brown rabbit appeared, eyes wide with surprise. "Nico, what are you doing here?" she asked, hopping backward. "Do you ever feel like something's missing?" Nico asked. "Even though you have everything you need?" Mira looked around nervously. "We're not supposed to talk about such things, but do you?" Nico persisted. After a moment, Mira nodded. "Sometimes I build extra carrot houses, just in case someone might visit, but no one ever does." That afternoon, they shared carrots and strawberries, a combination neither had tried before. They told stories and laughed until Mira pointed to the rising tide. "You'll have to go," she said sadly. As Nico hurried back, the hollow feeling was gone, but by morning, it had returned. Soon, Nico discovered that sandbars connected many islands at low tide. Before long, he wasn't the only one crossing them. Leo showed everyone how his moving island could transport them to new places. When it rained, they huddled together on Kai the Bear's island under enormous leaves. Not everyone joined in. Some islanders watched from a distance, content with their solitude. One evening, as friends gathered on Nico's island, Headmaster Owl swooped down unexpectedly. "This is not how things are done here," he declared. "But why not?" asked Nico. "We've discovered something important. Being alone isn't always the same as being happy." Headmaster Owl ruffled his feathers. "You won't always have sandbars to cross. What will you do when high tide comes?" The friends looked at each other thoughtfully. Then Leo the Turtle said quietly, "We'll remember that the sandbar will return, and while we wait, we'll wave to each other. Not quick, polite waves, but real ones that say, 'I see you there, and I'm glad you exist.'" That night, as Nico curled up in his den, the hollow feeling was gone. In its place was something warm, like invisible threads connecting his heart to his friends' hearts across the water. "Good night, island," he whispered as usual, then added something new. "Good night, friends. See you when the sandbar returns. Think together. Take a moment to reflect on these questions. You can write your thoughts, draw them, or discuss them with someone else. How is being alone different from feeling lonely? Can someone feel lonely even when they're surrounded by other people? How does that happen? Why do you think we need connections with others?" In the story, some islanders still prefer to stay on their own islands. Do you think that's okay? Why? What are some things that help you when you're feeling lonely? Have you ever felt lonely but didn't tell anyone? Why is it sometimes hard to talk about these feelings? Philosophy Window, Exploring Loneliness and Connection. Aristotle, a philosopher who lived in ancient Greece over 2,300 years ago, had a big idea about humans. He said, "We are social animals," meaning that connecting with others isn't just nice, it's necessary for us to truly flourish and be happy. According to Aristotle, a person living completely alone would miss out on important parts of what makes a good life. But thousands of years later, another group of thinkers called existentialists, like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, looked at things differently. They suggested that, in some ways, we are fundamentally alone in our experiences. Each of us sees the world through our own eyes, and no one can ever completely understand exactly how we feel or think. Is it possible that both views are true? Maybe we're like Nico and his friends. We each have our own islands, our unique thoughts, feelings, and experiences, but we also need sandbars to connect us to others. When we're alone by choice, reading a book, drawing, or just thinking, we might feel peaceful and content. But when we feel disconnected from others, even though we wish for connection, that's loneliness. Philosophers remind us that this feeling is part of being human. Everyone, even grown-ups, feels lonely sometimes. Your turn? My connection map. Materials needed, paper, colouring supplies. Draw an island in the centre of your paper. This is your special place. Around it, draw three islands representing people you feel connected to, They could be family members, friends, or even a pet. Draw sandbars connecting your island to theirs. On your own island, draw or write one thing you enjoy doing when you're alone. What makes this activity special just for you? On a separate small island, draw or write one way you could reach out to someone who might be feeling lonely. How could you be their sandbar? Bonus, if you want, you can add weather to your map. Sunny days might show times when being alone feels good. Cloudy or rainy days might show times when you felt lonely. What helps the sun come out again? Wonder more. Sometimes we need to be alone, to rest, to think, to dream. Being comfortable with our own company is a kind of strength. But other times, that hollow feeling Nico had reminds us that we're made for connection. Perhaps the wisest approach is learning when to enjoy our own island and when to cross the sandbar to another's. Next time you feel lonely, remember Nico's discovery. The feeling itself can be a guide, letting you know it might be time to reach out. And if the sandbar seems too far to cross right now, you can always start with a real wave, not a quick, polite one, but one that says, "I see you there, and I'm glad you exist." Question to carry with you: how can I enjoy my own island while still building sandbars to others? 2. What do we really need to be happy? Inspired by Epicurus, the picnic on Pebble Hill, Lila the rabbit had been planning for weeks. She had made special invitations with glitter and ribbons for her 3 best friends, Benny the bear, Fred the fox, and Tilly the turtle. "We're having the fanciest picnic ever on top of Pebble Hill this Saturday," she announced, hopping with excitement. "It has to be perfect. I'm bringing sparkling carrot juice in crystal bottles," Lila said proudly. "I'll make my triple stuffed berry cake with 7 layers of frosting," Benny rumbled happily. "And I'm bringing my new telescope so we can watch the sunset up close," Fred added with a swish of his tail. Tilly the turtle just smiled quietly and said, "I'll bring some apples." Lila tried not to look disappointed. "Just apples? For the fanciest picnic ever." When Saturday arrived, the 4 friends climbed Pebble Hill under a bright blue sky. But as they reached the top, clouds began to gather. "Oh!" gasped Benny, looking down at his beautiful cake. The heat from the climb had caused all 7 layers to slide sideways. "It's ruined." Lila reached into her basket for the sparkling carrot juice, but her face fell. "I was so excited about decorating the baskets that I forgot the juice at home." Just then, a gust of wind knocked over Fred's telescope. It tumbled down the hill with a crash. "My new telescope," Fred cried. The first raindrops began to fall. Everyone looked miserable, except Tilly. Slowly, the turtle reached into her small shell backpack. She pulled out a simple blanket and spread it under a large oak tree where the ground was still dry. "I brought apples," she said, placing 4 shiny red fruits on the blanket. "1 for each of us. Let's sit together and enjoy the breeze." With nothing else to do, they huddled close on the small blanket. Benny managed to save a handful of berries from his melted cake, and they took turns dipping their apple slices into the sweet juice. They laughed about the cake disaster and made up silly stories about what they might have seen through the telescope. When the rain stopped, a magnificent rainbow appeared across the valley. As the sun began to set, they watched the sky turn from blue to pink to gold. They didn't need a telescope to see how beautiful it was. "You know," Lila whispered as stars began to appear, "I wanted everything to be fancy and perfect. But this was actually perfect anyway." Tilly smiled. "Sometimes the simplest things are exactly what we need. Think together." Why did Lila and her friends think they needed fancy things for their picnic to be special? What do you think made the picnic feel perfect in the end? Have you ever had a time when something didn't go as planned but turned out wonderful anyway? Can simple things make us just as happy as big, expensive things? Why? What are three simple things that make you feel really happy? If you could only bring five things to a desert island, what would they be? Why? Philosophy Window, Epicurus, and The Secret to Happiness. Epicurus was a wise philosopher who lived in ancient Greece about 2300 years ago. In his time, many people thought that having lots of wealth, fancy possessions, and power was the key to happiness. But Epicurus had a surprising idea. He believed we don't need much at all to be truly happy. After thinking deeply about what makes a good life, Epicurus came to believe that three simple things are most important. Good friends we trust and enjoy spending time with. Simple food that satisfies our hunger. Peace of mind with time to think and rest. He created a garden where he lived quietly with friends. They grew their own food, had interesting conversations, and enjoyed simple pleasures like fresh bread and olives. Epicurus noticed something important. When people chase too much money, fame, or luxury, they often end up more stressed and anxious, not happier. They worry about losing what they have or always want more. Nothing is enough for the person who thinks enough is too little. Epicurus, he believed that understanding what we truly need versus what we merely want is the secret to feeling content. Like Tilly with her apples, Epicurus knew that sometimes less really is more. Your turn, my happiness basket. Materials needed. Paper, colouring supplies. Imagine you have a special basket that can hold only the most important things that bring you happiness. Draw a basket on your paper. Inside your basket, draw or write. 3. Simple things that make you happy, like hearing birds sing, the smell of rain, or a favourite book. 2 people you enjoy spending time with. 1 quiet moment that brings you peace, like watching clouds or feeling the sun on your face. Around the outside of your basket, draw some things that might seem exciting but don't fit in your happiness basket. Why didn't they make it inside? At the bottom of your page, write, enough for a happy life. Bonus activity for one whole day. Try to notice tiny joys you might usually overlook. The taste of your breakfast, a kind smile, a comfortable chair. Keep a little list of these simple pleasures. Wonder more. Epicurus thought that happiness is not about what we have, but how we feel about what we have. When Lila and her friends lost their fancy picnic items, they discovered something surprising. They already had everything they needed for a perfect day. Apples to share, stories to tell, a beautiful sunset, and each other. Maybe joy isn't waiting in bigger, better, or more expensive things. Maybe, like Tilly's apples, it's already right there in front of us. In smaller, quieter moments, we sometimes forget to notice. The next time you feel like you need something new to be happy, try this. Close your eyes and think of 3 simple things you already have that bring you joy. Like Epicurus in his garden, you might discover that enough is already a feast. Question to carry with you, what simple joys might I notice today if I look with fresh eyes? 3. Can I be brave enough to be me? Inspired by Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche's ideas can be deep, but with the right metaphor and story, they can be made accessible to kids. One of his most powerful ideas for younger minds is the concept of becoming who you are and embracing your uniqueness, even if it's hard. The song of the little firebird, every morning in Emberwood Forest, when the first light of dawn filtered through the leaves, the birds would begin their song. Always the same melody, passed down through generations. Chirp, chirp, tweet, tweet, chirp, chirp, tweet, tweet. It was what good birds did. It was tradition. It was order. Among them lived a small firebird named Solly. Her feathers glowed with soft orange and gold, like embers in a dying fire. She tried her best to fit in, to sing the morning song correctly, but every time she opened her beak, something different happened. Chirr, wheat, caw, trill, Ah! Notes tumbled out, wild and unpredictable, like sparks from a bonfire. High notes that soared to the clouds. Deep notes that rumbled like distant thunder. Strange melodies no one had heard before. The other birds would stare, their songs faltering. "That's not how the song goes," they chirped, frowning. "You're doing it wrong," said the robins. "You'll confuse the sunrise," warned the sparrows. "That's not how things are done in Emberwood," scolded Elder Owl, who led the morning chorus. So Solly tried to stay quiet. She would fly to the edge of the forest before dawn and practice the right song for hours. Chirp, chirp. Tweet. Tow-o-call. It was no use. The more she tried to sing like the others, the more her chest felt tight and heavy, like her inner fire was slowly going out. Her feathers, once bright with orange and gold, began to fade to a dull brown. One night, Solly couldn't sleep. She watched the stars from her nest and thought about tomorrow's morning song. The very idea made her wings feel heavy. "I can't do this anymore," she whispered to the moon. Before dawn, she flew to the very top of the great pine that stood at the center of Emberwood. She watched as the first light began to paint the eastern sky with gold and pink. The other birds stirred in their nests, preparing for the same morning song they always sang. Solly took a deep breath. Her heart pounded, and then she let go. She opened her beak and released her true song. It burst from her like a flame, wild and fierce and beautiful. It soared and dipped and spiraled. It contained joy and sadness and wonder all at once. "Share a lee caw trill, whoosh tititara." As she sang, something magical happened. Her faded feathers began to glow again, brighter than before, until she blazed like a small sun atop the great pine. The forest fell completely silent when she finished. Solly held her breath, waiting for the laughter, the criticism, the corrections. But then, from somewhere below, a small chickadee whispered, "That was beautiful." "I've never heard anything like it," added a timid warbler. And then a young robin attempted a new note, not from the traditional song, but something slightly different. Then a blue jay tried, adding his own twist. A finch followed with a completely new pattern. Soon the entire forest was filled with songs, all different, all unique, all true. Some birds still sang the old song, and that was fine too, but many discovered notes and melodies they'd been holding inside for years. Elder Owl fluttered up to perch beside Solly. "I've been leading the morning chorus for 50 years, he said softly, "and I have never heard the forest sound so alive." From that day on, the mornings in Emberwood were never the same, and neither was Solly. Her fire burned bright and steady, warming any bird brave enough to sing their own true song. Think together. Why did Solly feel she had to sing like everyone else in Emberwood? What do you think gave Solly the courage to finally sing her true song? Have you ever felt like you needed to be more like others instead of being yourself? What happened? Is it always easy to be yourself? What makes it hard sometimes? What do you think happens when we hide our true selves for too long? Who are the people in your life who help you feel brave enough to be you? Philosophy Window, Nietzsche, and the Fire Within. Friedrich Nietzsche, pronounced Nietzsche, was a philosopher with wild ideas and an even wilder mustache. He lived in Germany during the 1800s and wrote about finding the courage to live differently than others expect. Nietzsche believed that each person has something like a fire inside, a unique spirit and power that is theirs alone. He thought this inner fire was the most precious thing we have, but he noticed something troubling. The world often tries to make everyone the same. Schools, rules, and even friends might pressure us to fit in rather than stand out. Like the birds in Emberwood singing the same song, people often follow the crowd instead of finding their own path. Nietzsche had a bold message, "Don't let your fire go out." He wrote, "You must become who you are." This means discovering your own special talents, thoughts, and dreams, even if they're different from everyone else's, and having the courage to share them with the world. Nietzsche also believed that hard times and struggles could actually help our inner fire grow stronger. Just like how Solly's uncomfortable feelings eventually led her to sing her true song, our challenges can help us discover who we really are. One of his most famous ideas was something called the spirit of the lion, a brave, powerful part of ourselves that can roar yes to our own path, even when others say no. Your turn, design your fire. Materials needed, paper, colouring supplies. Every firebird has a different pattern of flames. Yours is as unique as you are. Draw a large flame shape in the centre of your paper. Make it big and bold. This represents your inner fire. Inside your flame, write or draw. 3. Things that make you uniquely you, talents, quirks, or things you love. One time you did something brave or different, even though it was hard. A dream or hope you have that feels truly your own. Around your flame, you might draw colours that represent different parts of your personality, small symbols of things that help your fire grow brighter. A protective circle to show how you'll keep your fire safe. Dot at the bottom of your page, write this promise to yourself. This is my fire, and I'll keep it burning. Bonus challenge, share your flame design with someone you trust. Tell them one way they help your fire burn brighter. Wonder more. When Friedrich Nietzsche said, "Become who you are," he wasn't just giving advice. He was offering an invitation to one of life's greatest adventures. Like Solly the Firebird, you might sometimes feel pressure to sing the same song as everyone else. You might worry what will happen if you share your true voice, your real thoughts, your different way of seeing the world. But imagine if Solly had kept her unique song locked away forever. The forest would never have awakened to new possibilities. The other birds might never have found their own voices. Your fire, the special combination of thoughts, feelings, talents, and dreams that make you you, is not an accident. No one else in the whole wide world has exactly your flame. Sometimes protecting your fire might feel lonely or difficult. That's okay. Even Nietzsche, with all his bold ideas, sometimes felt misunderstood. But he kept writing, kept thinking, kept becoming himself. The world needs your particular light. Question to carry with you: what small, brave step could I take today to let my true fire shine? Situare, what if the monster is part of me? Inspired by Carl Jung. For kids, we can explore Carl Jung's ideas of the shadow, dreams, and finding your true self. Here's a story around Jung's concept of the shadow, the hidden parts of ourselves we sometimes ignore or fear, but that can help us grow if we understand them. The mirror in the forest. Luna, the raccoon, was known throughout Whispering Woods as the nicest animal around. She always cleaned up after others, even when no one noticed. She helped her friends with their problems, but never mentioned her own. And no matter how she really felt inside, Luna never, ever raised her voice. What a perfect friend, the other animals would say. Always so kind, so helpful, so good. Luna smiled when they said this, but sometimes her smile felt tight, like a mask she couldn't take off. One misty morning, Luna decided to explore the deepest part of the forest, a place the animals called the Forgotten Grove. The trees grew close together there, their branches weaving into a roof that blocked most of the sunlight. As she picked her way carefully through tangled roots and fallen logs, Luna spotted something unusual leaning against an ancient oak tree. It was a mirror with a carved wooden frame covered in vines and moss. It looked very, very old. Curious, Luna stepped closer and peered into the glass. She gasped and jumped backward. The reflection, looking back, wasn't the neat, smiling raccoon everyone knew. This raccoon had wild, ruffled fur standing on end. Its eyes blazed with a fierce light. Its paws were clenched into fists, and its mouth was open as if in mid-shout. "That's not me," Luna cried, rubbing her eyes. "I'm not like that at all." She turned and hurried away, her heart pounding. That evening, she tried to forget about the strange mirror. She helped Rabbit organize her burrow and listened patiently to Squirrel's endless chatter, all while wearing her usual pleasant smile. But when she got home and washed her face before bed, she nearly screamed. In her small bathroom mirror was the same wild reflection from the forest, glaring back at her. "Go away," Luna whispered. "You're not real." The next morning, the reflection was gone from her bathroom mirror. With a sigh of relief, Luna went about her day, helping Fox carry firewood, even though her back ached from yesterday's chores. But when Fox accidentally dropped a log on Luna's foot and didn't even apologize, something strange happened. For a brief moment, Luna felt a hot spark of anger rise up inside her. And in that exact moment, she caught her reflection in a puddle of rainwater. There was the wild raccoon again, looking exactly how her anger felt. For days, the strange reflection followed Luna. It appeared everywhere, in windows, in the pond, even in shiny spoons. It always seemed to show what Luna was feeling inside, not what she showed on the outside. Grumpy, when she pretended not to be annoyed. Tearful when she forced a cheerful laugh, exhausted when she said, "Of course I can help." Lonely when surrounded by friends who never really saw her. At first, Luna was terrified. Was she turning into some kind of monster? But after a while, she became curious. One evening, she decided to return to the Forgotten Grove to find the original mirror. The old mirror was still there, leaning against the oak tree. This time, when Luna looked into it, she didn't run away. The wild raccoon looked back at her, waiting. "Why are you following me?" Luna asked quietly. The reflection's mouth moved with her own, but somehow the voice that answered seemed to come from inside her head. "I am you," it said simply. "I'm the part you pretend isn't real. Your anger, your sadness, your tiredness, your truth. But I can't be like you," Luna whispered. "Everyone expects me to be good and helpful all the time. Being honest doesn't make you bad," the reflection said. "And hiding your real feelings doesn't make you good. It just makes you incomplete." Luna and her reflection sat in silence for a long time as darkness fell in the forest. The moon rose, casting silver light through the trees. Finally, Luna did something brave. She reached out and placed her paw against the mirror, as if trying to hold the hand of her other self. "I'm scared of you," she admitted. "But I think I understand why you're here." The wild raccoon in the mirror nodded, its fierce eyes softening just a little. From that day on, Luna began to change, not in big, dramatic ways, but in small, important ones. She still helped her friends, but she also asked for help when she needed it. She told the truth when she was upset, instead of pretending everything was fine. And sometimes, when she felt angry, she'd find a private place to growl and stomp until the feeling passed. Her friends were surprised at first. "You seem different," Rabbit said one day. "I'm more myself now," Luna replied with a smile. "A real one this time, not tight or forced." She wasn't perfect anymore, but she was whole, and whenever she glimpsed her reflection now, in mirrors or windows or pools of water, she saw just one raccoon looking back, neither too wild nor too tame, but somewhere in between. Just right. Think together. Why do you think Luna tried to hide certain parts of herself? Have you ever acted one way on the outside while feeling differently on the inside? What was that like? What do you think the mirror was really showing Luna? Why might it be hard to show others when we're sad, angry, or tired? Can someone be both kind and honest about their difficult feelings? What might happen if we hide our true feelings for a very long time? Who are the people in your life who see and accept all of you, even the parts that feel messy? Philosophy Window, Jung and the Shadow Within. Carl Jung, pronounced Jung, was a wise thinker who lived about 100 years ago and spent his life studying the human mind. He wore round glasses, had kind eyes, and asked big questions about why people behave the way they do. Jung discovered something important. We all have parts of ourselves that we don't always want to see or show to others. He called this hidden part our shadow. The shadow isn't bad or evil, it's simply made up of the feelings, thoughts, and qualities we've learned to hide, the anger we swallow when someone is unfair, the sadness we cover with a smile, the jealousy we pretend we don't feel, the messy, imperfect parts we think others won't accept. Jung noticed that many people spend their whole lives running from their shadow, trying to be perfect or good all the time. But he discovered something surprising. The more we try to push away our shadow, the stronger it grows inside us. Instead, Jung suggested something brave. What if we turned around and got to know our shadow? What if, like Luna with her reflection, we could say hello to these hidden parts of ourselves? He wrote, "One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious." In simpler words, we don't grow wiser by pretending to be perfect. We grow wiser by understanding all of who we are. Jung believed that our shadow can actually become our teacher and friend. When we listen to our difficult feelings instead of hiding them, we become more whole, more honest, and strangely enough, more truly kind. Your turn, my mirror friend. Materials needed: paper, colouring supplies, optional, small mirror. Draw a mirror frame in the centre of your paper. Make it any shape you like, round, square, or something creative like a cloud or star. Inside your mirror, draw or write a feeling you sometimes try to hide from others, a time when you felt two different emotions at once, like being happy but nervous or excited but scared. One way you could be more honest with yourself or others about how you really feel dot around the outside of your mirror frame, you might add colon dot colours. That represent different feelings, friendly monsters or creatures that represent parts of yourself you're getting to know. Gentle reminders like it's okay to feel or all of me belongs. You'd like, find a real mirror and practice looking at yourself with kind eyes. Notice how many different feelings can show on your face. Remember, all of those feelings are important parts of you. Bonus activity with a trusted grown-up or friend. Practice using I feel statements, like I feel frustrated when, or I feel happy when. This is one way we can honour our shadow instead of hiding it. Wonder more. Carl Jung believed that the parts of ourselves we try to hide away are often holding gifts we don't yet understand. Our anger might be protecting something we care about deeply. Our sadness might be showing us what matters most to our hearts. Our fear might be helping us stay safe until we're ready for something new. Like Luna the raccoon, we might worry that showing our true feelings will make others like us less. But Jung discovered a beautiful truth. When we can accept all parts of ourselves, the good and the difficult, we actually become more authentic, more compassionate, and more connected to others. This doesn't mean we act on every feeling we have. Luna didn't start shouting at her friends or refusing to help. Instead, she learned to listen to her feelings, understand them, and then choose how to respond. Jung once wrote that wholeness is not achieved by cutting off a portion of one's being, but by integration of the contraries. In other words, we become our truest selves not by hiding parts away, but by bringing all the pieces together. Question to carry with you: if my shadow could speak to me today, what might it be trying to teach me? Pet, are you really here right now? Inspired by Martin Heidegger. Heidegger's ideas are deep and abstract, but for kids we can translate his concept of being into a story about presence, awareness, and what it means to truly be in the world, not just rushing through it. The day Elio stopped rushing, Elio the squirrel was always in a hurry. His paws were a blur as he scampered up trees, gathering more nuts than he could ever eat. His tail twitched constantly, even in his sleep. His words tumbled out so quickly that other forest creatures often asked him to repeat himself. "No time to wait," was Elio's favourite saying. "There's always more to do." Each morning, he'd make a list of all the tasks he needed to finish. Collect exactly 87 acorns. Restock the east and west burrows. Race rabbit and win. Practice jumping between the tallest trees. Plan tomorrow's route for maximum efficiency. Elio was so proud of how much he accomplished every day. While other animals took breaks, Elio moved faster. While they watched clouds, he spotted new acorn trees. His burrow had the biggest stockpile in the forest, and everyone said he'd be the only one prepared when winter came. But something strange was happening. Despite all his rushing and gathering, Elio couldn't remember what the forest looked like anymore. What colour were the flowers by the stream? Was the old oak leaning left or right? He couldn't say. One cloudy afternoon, Elio was racing along his usual path when he spotted something unusual, a small snail perched on a mossy log, completely still. Elio skidded to a stop, nearly dropping his acorns. "Aren't you bored just sitting there?" he asked, genuinely confused. "Shouldn't you be, you know, going somewhere?" The snail turned slowly and smiled. "Nope," he replied. "I'm being..." Elio's whiskers twitched with impatience. "Being what?" "Everyone's being something all the time. I'm being a squirrel who's getting things done." But the snail just tilted his head curiously. "Are you?" Before Elio could answer, a raindrop fell, and he dashed away to protect his gathered nuts. But the snail's question followed him all the way home, echoing strangely in his mind. "Are you?" That night, a summer storm rolled across the forest. Thunder kept Elio awake, and he found himself sitting at the entrance to his burrow, watching lightning flash across the sky. His list for tomorrow sat beside him, but for some reason, he couldn't focus on it. "Are you?" Almost without meaning to, Elio set his list aside and just sat. He felt the cool night air on his fur. He listened to the raindrops tap-tap-tapping on leaves. He smelled the rich, earthy scent of wet soil. He watched how each flash of lightning revealed a different forest, mysteriously beautiful for just a moment, before disappearing again. For the first time in as long as he could remember, Elio wasn't rushing. He wasn't planning. He wasn't even gathering. He was just there. A strange feeling spread through his chest. Like a knot he hadn't known was there, had suddenly loosened. His breathing slowed. His tail, for once, was still. "Oh," Elio whispered to no one, "is this what it means to be alive? To be here?" When morning came, Elio woke to sunlight filtering through leaves. His list sat where he'd left it, but somehow it didn't seem as important as before. He still gathered acorns that day. Winter was coming, after all. But this time, as he worked, he noticed things. The deep, reddish-brown of acorns against green moss. The rhythm of his own breath as he climbed. The satisfying weight of each nut in his paws. The way other animals nodded hello as he passed. The strange thing was, Elio still gathered plenty of acorns. But now, when Rabbit asked him to stop and watch a butterfly, he did. When the blue jays sang, he paused to listen. And when he passed the mossy log again, he smiled at the snail. "I think I understand now," Elio said. The snail simply nodded. "Being takes practice." "I'm learning," replied Elio, and this time he wasn't in a hurry to leave. "Think together. Why do you think Elio was always rushing around? What was he trying to achieve? What did the snail mean by I'm being? How is that different from just existing? Have you ever been so busy that you forgot to notice the world around you? What did that feel like? Why do you think Elio could still gather plenty of acorns even when he slowed down? When was the last time you felt really, truly present in a moment? What was happening? What are some things that help you feel connected to the here and now? Do you think humans today are more like Elio at the beginning of the story, or more like the snail? Why? Philosophy Window, Heidegger, and the Art of Being. Martin Heidegger, pronounced Heidegger, was a philosopher who asked a question that seems simple but is actually enormous. What does it mean to truly be? Born in Germany in 1889, Heidegger noticed something troubling about how people lived. He saw that humans often get so caught up in the busy world of doing things and using things that we forget to notice our own existence, our being in the world, as he called it. Heidegger created a special word for human existence, Dasein, pronounced Dasein, which means being there or presence. He thought that what makes humans special is that we can actually wonder about our own existence. A rock exists, but it doesn't know it exists. We do, but Heidegger worried that modern life, with all its technology, schedules, and distractions, was causing people to live in what he called an inauthentic way. Like Elio rushing through the forest, we go through our days on autopilot, never really experiencing the world or questioning what matters. To live authentically, Heidegger suggested we need to pay attention to the present moment, like Elio watching the lightning. Notice how we are connected to everything around us. Accept that our time is limited, which makes each moment precious. Question what truly matters in our lives. Heidegger believed that when we slow down and truly notice the world, we don't just see trees and rocks and other people, we begin to understand our place in it all. To be alive isn't just about existing, it's about being awake to life itself. Your turn, now map, materials needed, paper, colouring supplies, a quiet moment. Find a comfortable spot where you can sit quietly for a few minutes. Take 3 deep breaths. Now, as you look around you, create your now map. In the centre of your paper, draw a small version of yourself. Around this centre, create 5 sections labelled colon dots. Draw or write 3 things you can see right now. Here, write 2 things you can hear, even tiny sounds. Feel. Note how your body feels. Is it warm? Cool? Do you feel the chair beneath you? Think. What thoughts are passing through your mind? Wonder. What questions or feelings does this moment bring up? At the bottom of your map, write, this is what it means to be here, now. Bonus activity. Try making a now map in different places. At home, outside, somewhere new. How does your experience of being there change in each place? Wonder more. Martin Heidegger thought that being truly alive means noticing life as it's happening. He believed we're most real, most ourselves, when we step out of autopilot and become aware of our own existence. Like Elio, we often rush through our days checking things off lists, looking at screens, thinking about what's next. We might finish the day having done many things, but without really experiencing any of them. But what if, like the snail, we could practice being more often? What if we could feel the sun on our skin or the weight of a book in our hands and think, I am here, experiencing this? Heidegger might say that these moments of presence, when we suddenly wake up to our own existence, are glimpses of what it truly means to be human. Not just to exist, but to know we exist. Not just to pass through the world, but to wonder at it. The next time you catch yourself rushing like Elio, try pausing for just a moment. Look around as if you're seeing the world for the very first time. Feel your breath. Notice your thoughts. Remember that you are here, now, alive in this particular moment that will never come again. Question to carry with you. What might you discover if you spent a little time each day just being instead of always doing? Sest, what if I'm afraid to choose? Inspired by Søren Kierkegaard. Søren Kierkegaard is often considered the father of existentialism, and for kids, one of his most relatable themes is making choices, especially when you're afraid of making the wrong one. He believed that becoming yourself means taking a leap, even if it's scary. The bridge nobody crossed. In the peaceful village of Willowbend, everyone followed the same paths every day. They walked to the same gardens, played in the same fields, and told the same stories at night. Just beyond the edge of the village stood an old wooden bridge. It stretched across a misty ravine and led to a mysterious forest where the trees seemed to glow with a gentle, strange light. Everyone in Willowbend knew about the bridge and the forest beyond. Parents whispered about it. Children made up songs about it. Some said the forest held treasures beyond imagination. Others warned of dangers lurking among the glowing trees. A few suggested it might simply be different, new, unknown. But no one ever crossed the bridge. Too risky, the village elders would say, shaking their heads. What if it's a terrible mistake? Better to stay where things are certain, parents told their children. What if you get lost and can't find your way back? Theo the hedgehog lived in a cozy burrow near the bridge. Every morning, while the other animals headed to their usual spots, Theo would wander to the edge of the bridge and stare across at the glowing forest. Something about it pulled at him, like a song he couldn't quite remember. But each time he placed one paw on the first wooden plank, his stomach would knot with worry. What if I go and it's awful? He would think, backing away. What if I stay and always wonder? He would think, stepping forward again. Day after day, Theo stood at the edge, caught between two fears, the fear of making the wrong choice and the fear of making no choice at all. Maybe tomorrow, he'd whisper to himself each evening, returning to his burrow. After many such days, Theo decided to ask for advice. He visited Elder Owl, who was said to be the wisest creature in Willowbend. "I can't decide whether to cross the bridge," Theo explained, his spines quivering with anxiety. "Everyone says it's dangerous, but I feel drawn to it. What should I do?" Elder Owl blinked slowly. "That's not my question to answer," he said gently. "It's yours." "But what if I make the wrong choice?" Theo asked, his voice small. "Ah," said Elder Owl, "perhaps the only truly wrong choice is letting fear decide for you." Theo thought about this all night. In the morning, he once again stood at the edge of the bridge. The familiar knot of worry tightened in his stomach. "I might be scared forever," he thought, "or I could take one step." He closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and placed his paw firmly on the first plank of the bridge. His heart raced wildly. The second step was even harder than the first. By the third step, Theo was trembling. But with each step, something unexpected happened. Beneath his fear, Theo began to feel something else, a tingling sense of being fully, completely alive. His senses sharpened. He noticed the creaking of the wood beneath his paws, the cool mist rising from below, the fresh scent of pine carried on the breeze. When he reached the middle of the bridge, Theo paused. Behind him lay everything familiar and safe. Ahead lay everything unknown. For a moment, the weight of this choice felt overwhelming. "I could still go back," he thought. But then he realized even choosing to return would now be his choice, not one made from habit or fear, but from freedom. Theo took another step, and another. When he finally reached the other side, he discovered the forest was indeed more beautiful than anyone had imagined. Not because it was perfect or magical, but because it was real, and he had chosen to discover it for himself. The trees weren't actually glowing, but their leaves caught the sunlight in ways Willowbend's trees never did. There were new fruits to taste, new paths to explore, new perspectives from which to see his village across the ravine. That evening, Theo returned to Willowbend. Some animals were curious about what he'd found. Others seemed uncomfortable with his choice. But Theo noticed something had changed inside himself. The knot of worry was still there sometimes, but it no longer seemed so important. What mattered was that he had faced the choice that was his alone to make. The next morning, Theo noticed another young animal standing hesitantly at the edge of the bridge. "Is it scary?" they asked him. "Yes," Theo answered honestly. "But so is never crossing. Think together. Why do you think everyone in Willowbend was afraid to cross the bridge? What were the two different fears Theo experienced? Which do you think would be harder to face? Why didn't Elder Owl tell Theo what choice to make? Have you ever felt scared to try something new or make an important choice? What happened? Can we ever be 100% certain about how a choice will turn out? If not, how do we decide? Is there a difference between choosing something and having others choose for you?" Theo crossed the bridge alone. Do you think that was important? Why or why not? Philosophy Window, Kierkegaard, and the Leap of Faith. Søren Kierkegaard, pronounced Søren Kierkegaard, was a philosopher who lived in Denmark during the 1800s. He often walked alone through the streets of Copenhagen, thinking deeply about what it means to be human and to live a meaningful life. While other philosophers of his time focused on finding absolute truth through reason and logic, Kierkegaard became interested in something different: the experience of making important choices when we can't be completely certain of the outcome. He noticed that the most significant decisions in life, like who to befriend, what to believe in, or what kind of person to become, can't be made using only facts and logic. These choices require something else: a leap of faith. A leap of faith doesn't mean choosing blindly or foolishly. It means thinking carefully about your options, accepting that you can't know everything in advance, making a choice anyway, with your whole heart, taking responsibility for your decision. Kierkegaard believed that these moments of choice are what make each of us unique. No one else can make your deepest choices for you. When you choose, you begin to create yourself. He wrote, "The most common form of despair is not being who you are." By this, he meant that when we avoid making important choices, when we let others decide for us, or when we just drift along doing what everyone else does, we never truly become ourselves. Kierkegaard also understood that choosing can be terrifying. He called this feeling anxiety and saw it as the natural response to freedom. The butterflies in your stomach when facing a big decision aren't something to avoid. They're a sign that you're alive with possibility. Real courage, Kierkegaard thought, isn't about being fearless. It's about feeling the fear, understanding the risk, and choosing anyway. Your turn, my leap of faith. Materials needed: paper, colouring supplies. Draw a bridge spanning across your page. Make it whatever style you like: an old wooden bridge, a modern suspension bridge, or even a magical rainbow bridge. On one side of the bridge, where the journey begins, write or draw something you feel nervous about trying or choosing. It could be something small, like trying a new food or activity, or something bigger, like standing up for yourself or admitting you need help. On the other side of the bridge, the destination, write or draw what might happen if you make this choice. Include both possibilities that excite you and those that worry you. On the bridge itself, write, "What will help me take the first step?" Then add at least three things that might give you courage: perhaps people who support you, small steps you could try first, or words you could say to yourself. At the bottom of your page, copy this quote from Kierkegaard: "Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward." Bonus activity: find a small twig or stick. When you're facing a choice that makes you nervous, hold the stick and imagine it's your own tiny bridge. Sometimes holding something physical can help us feel braver. Wonder more. Søren Kierkegaard understood something important about being human. We live in the space between what is and what could be. Every day, we face choices that shape who we become. Some choices are small, like which book to read or game to play. Others are larger, like how to treat someone who's different from us, or whether to speak up when something seems wrong. But each choice, however tiny, adds to the story of who you are. Kierkegaard said, "You become yourself through the choices you make." This means that who you are isn't fixed or decided from the beginning. You create yourself, choice by choice, step by step, bridge by bridge. The scary part of this truth is that no one else can do your choosing for you. The wonderful part is that your life is yours to shape. Sometimes, like Theo, you might stand at the edge of your own bridge, caught between the comfort of the familiar and the call of something new. You might feel the knot of worry in your stomach. You might wish someone would just tell you what to do. But perhaps, in those moments, you can remember that the butterflies in your stomach aren't there to stop you. They're there to remind you that you're alive with possibility. Question to carry with you: what small choice could you make today that would help you become more fully yourself? 7. What does it mean to love out loud? Inspired by bell hooks. Bell hooks is a wonderful philosopher, especially for kids. Her work centers on love, justice, community, and the power of learning and being seen. For younger readers, we can focus on her belief that love is an action, not just a feeling, and that choosing love is a way of choosing to care, listen, and make the world better. The garden that grew from kindness. In a small town called Brightpatch, nestled between rolling hills, stood Oakbury School. The building was neat and orderly, with straight rows of desks and perfectly aligned books on the shelves. The walls were painted pale blue, and the hallways echoed with whispers. A large wooden sign hung in the main hallway: Oakbury School rules, no loud talking, no messes, no trouble. Most students followed these rules without question. They walked in straight lines, raised their hands to speak, and kept their voices low. Everything was calm, quiet, and predictable. And then there was Mina the mouse. Mina had a laugh that bubbled up from deep inside her, spilling out like music. Her backpack was always bursting with books, art supplies, and half-finished projects. Her questions seemed endless. Why can't we paint during lunch? Could we move our desks into a circle instead of rows? Why is Kavi sitting alone at recess? What if we started a kindness club? Some kids thought Mina was strange. Some teachers sighed when her hand shot up yet again. "Mina," they'd say gently but firmly, "perhaps you could quiet down a bit." One rainy Tuesday, during indoor recess, Mina noticed something. Behind the bookshelf near the back of the room, a small fox named Leo was sitting alone, his shoulders shaking slightly. Mina recognized that shake. Leo was crying, trying hard not to be seen or heard. Instead of looking away, which would have been easier, Mina grabbed her lunchbox and walked over. "Is this seat taken?" she asked, pointing to the floor beside him. Leo quickly wiped his eyes and shook his head. Mina sat down and opened her lunchbox. "I have an extra cookie," she said. "My mom always packs two, just in case I meet someone who needs one." Leo hesitated, then took the cookie. They sat in silence for a moment. "You don't have to tell me why you're sad," Mina said finally. "But I'm good at listening if you want to." Slowly, Leo began to talk. His family had moved to Brightpatch just a month ago. He missed his old friends. He felt invisible in this new school where everyone already seemed to know each other. "I feel like I don't matter here," Leo whispered. Mina looked straight into Leo's eyes. "You matter," she said firmly, "and not just to me. You matter, period." The next day, Mina brought an extra chair to her lunch table and saved it for Leo. The day after that, She introduced him to Zara the rabbit, who loved to draw just like Leo did. Something small but significant had begun to shift in room 12. Javier the hedgehog started bringing extra pencils to share when he noticed someone had forgotten theirs. Zara began leaving tiny drawings on people's desks, personalized notes that said, "I see you," without words. Omar the owl organized a buddy system for math, so no one had to struggle with difficult problems alone. Slowly, the classroom began to change. Colorful artwork appeared on walls that had been blank before. The bookshelves became more jumbled as students shared their favorite stories. During group projects, chairs scraped across the floor as kids eagerly formed circles rather than staying in rows. Sometimes it was messy, sometimes it was noisy, but it was also warmer, somehow, as if the air itself had become kinder. One morning, the students arrived to find that someone had painted a new sign above the classroom door. In rainbow letters, it read, "Love is something you do." Miss Finch, their teacher, looked at the sign thoughtfully. Then, instead of asking who had broken the no messes rule, she smiled. "I think," she said, "this might be more important than our old rules." By spring, the changes had spread beyond room 12. A student-led garden appeared in a corner of the schoolyard that had always been empty. Kids from different grades worked together to build birdhouses and plant flowers. Even Principal Badger, who had always been strict about keeping the grass unruffled, could be seen occasionally helping with the watering. On the last day of school, as Mina packed up her even messier-than-usual backpack, Miss Finch handed her a small envelope. Inside was a note that read, "Thank you for teaching me that love isn't just something we feel, it's something we do. You helped our classroom grow into a garden." Mina smiled, tucking the note carefully into her pocket. The garden would need tending over the summer, of course, but she wasn't worried. Seeds of kindness, once planted, have a way of continuing to grow. Think together. What specific things did Mina do that helped others feel seen and valued? Why do you think some people at Oakbury School were uncomfortable with Mina's questions and actions at first? When have you felt truly seen or heard by someone else? What did they do that made you feel that way? What's the difference between rules that keep us safe and rules that might keep us from showing love? Have you ever shown love through your actions? What did you do and how did it feel? Can love be quiet sometimes? Can it be loud other times? What might quiet love and loud love look like? If you were going to add one new rule to your classroom or home that would help love grow, what would it be? Philosophy Window, Bell Hooks and Love as Action. Bell Hooks was a remarkable thinker who wrote her name without capital letters because she wanted people to focus on her ideas rather than on her as a person. Born in Kentucky in 1952, she grew up during a time when many people were treated unfairly because of their skin color or because they were girls instead of boys. Through her life experiences and deep thinking, Bell Hooks came to an important realization: love is much more than just a warm, fuzzy feeling. In fact, she believed love isn't mainly about feeling at all. It's about doing. Love is an action, she wrote, never simply a feeling. While many people talk about love in greeting cards or songs, Hooks focused on love as a powerful force for creating better classrooms, homes, and communities. She outlined what she called a love ethic that included attention, truly seeing and hearing each other, care, taking action to support others' growth and well-being, knowledge, learning what others need and how to respond, responsibility, showing up consistently for those we care about, respect, treating everyone as having equal value and importance, trust, building safe spaces where people can be their true selves, commitment, choosing to keep loving even when it's difficult, Hooks believed that learning to love well is perhaps the most important skill we can develop. To love well is the task in all meaningful relationships, she wrote. Not just romantic ones, all of them. She also thought that love requires both courage and practice. It takes bravery to speak up when something isn't fair, to apologize when we make mistakes, or to reach out to someone who seems lonely. And just like learning to read or ride a bike, we get better at loving through daily practice. Perhaps most importantly, bell hooks taught that love isn't just personal, it's political. When we choose to act with love, we help create a world where everyone is valued and can thrive. She called this revolutionary love, love big enough to transform not just hearts and minds, but entire communities and systems. Your turn, love is a verb. Materials needed, paper, colouring supplies, optional, magazines for collage. When bell hooks said love is a verb, she meant that love is most powerful when it's expressed through actions. Let's explore what love looks like in action. Create a love action list by dividing your paper into three sections. In the first section, write or draw three ways you can show love at school or with friends. These might be noticing when someone feels left out and including them, standing up for someone being treated unfairly, really listening when someone shares something important, celebrating others' successes without jealousy. In the second section, write or draw two ways you can practice loving yourself. These could include speaking kindly to yourself when you make mistakes, taking care of your body with rest, movement, and nourishment, making time for activities that bring you joy, asking for help when you need it. In the third section, write or draw one way you could help your larger community. This might be picking up litter in a park, creating art that brightens a public space, writing a letter to express concern about an issue you care about, finding ways to support those with less than you have. At the top of your page, write, I choose love. Decorate your list with colours, patterns, or images that remind you of what love in action feels like. Bonus activity, for 1 week, try to do at least one action from your list each day. Keep a small journal noting what you did and how it affected both you and others. Wonder more. Bell hooks believed that love, real active love, has the power to help us grow into our fullest selves. When we act with love, we not only nurture others, but also become more whole ourselves. She wrote, "The moment we choose to love, we begin to move against domination, against oppression. The moment we choose to love, we begin to move towards freedom. This means that even small acts of love can be revolutionary." When Mina sat beside Leo and told him he mattered, she wasn't just being nice. She was helping create a classroom where everyone could feel valued. When the students started checking in on each other and sharing their resources, they weren't just being helpful. They were building a community based on care rather than competition. Love doesn't always mean being perfectly agreeable or avoiding difficult conversations. Sometimes, loving someone means gently telling them a truth they might not want to hear. Sometimes, loving your community means speaking up against rules or practices that aren't fair. Love in action requires courage. It asks us to notice when things aren't right, to extend ourselves for others, and to believe that our small actions matter, that they can, drop by drop, help create the kind of world we wish to live in. What's something you could do today? Something specific and concrete that would put love into action. It doesn't have to be big or dramatic. Remember how Mina's simple act of sharing a cookie and listening without judgment started a chain reaction of kindness. Question to carry with you: how might my actions today help love grow in the spaces where I live, learn, and play? Awesome. What if someone sees the world differently? Inspired by R&D Laing. R&D Laing challenged how we think about madness, sanity, and how society shapes the mind. For kids, we can gently explore his ideas about feelings that don't get heard, people who seem different, and how understanding others can be an act of deep care. Here's a story that reflects Lange's belief that sometimes what we call crazy is really someone trying to express pain no one is listening to. The boy with the umbrella on sunny days. In the town of Clearville, weather forecasts were simple. Rain meant staying inside, clouds meant wearing jackets, and sunshine meant everyone went outside to play, laugh, and enjoy the brightness. Everyone, that is, except for Remy. On the sunniest days, when other children raced to the playground, Remy would slowly walk to school carrying a large blue umbrella. He'd open it wide above his head, even though there wasn't a cloud in sight. "The sun feels too loud," he'd explain when asked. "It's like the brightness is shouting at me." The other children would exchange glances. "But the sun doesn't make noise," they'd say, giggling behind their hands. "That's just weird." Teachers would gently suggest he put the umbrella away. "You'll feel better if you act more like the other children," they'd say. "It's important to fit in." Even Remy's parents worried. "We just want him to be normal," they whispered when they thought he couldn't hear. But Remy kept his umbrella open, walking through sunny days in his small circle of shade, his eyes less squinted, his shoulders less tense. Alia noticed. She sat behind Remy in class and watched how he relaxed when he could sit in the shadowy corner, how he flinched when the classroom got too bright or too noisy. She saw how he covered his ears during fire drills when others just held their hands over their hearts. One quiet afternoon during library time, Alia sat down next to Remy. "What's it like?" she asked softly. "Inside your head, I mean." Remy looked up, surprised. No one had ever asked him that before. He thought for a moment. "It's like..." He paused, searching for the right words. Everyone's shouting, even when no one's talking. Colours are so bright they hurt. The lights buzz like angry bees. Tag bells sound like ambulances. "That sounds hard," Alia said. Remy nodded. "The umbrella helps. It makes a small, quiet space." The next day was brilliantly sunny. As Remy walked to school under his blue umbrella, he heard quick footsteps behind him. "Wait up," called Alia. She was carrying a small red umbrella, which she opened with a flourish. "I thought maybe I could try it your way today," she said, falling into step beside him. Under their umbrellas, they walked together, noticing things often missed in the rush to get to school, the pattern of shadows on the sidewalk, the whisper of leaves in the slight breeze, the way the world seemed calmer, less harsh. At recess, instead of running to the swings, Alia joined Remy under the oak tree where he always sat. She'd brought paper and coloured pencils. "Can you show me what a loud sun looks like?" she asked. Remy picked up a yellow pencil and began to draw jagged, spiky lines radiating outward. Alia drew too, a softer sun with gentle rays. "They're both real," Remy said, looking at their drawings side by side. "Just different." Gradually, other children grew curious. What were Remy and Alia always drawing under that tree? Why did they sometimes laugh so hard when no one had told a joke? A few brave souls wandered over to look. "Can I try sitting under the umbrella?" asked one boy. "Could you draw what music looks like to you?" asked another. Soon, a small group gathered regularly in the shade of the oak tree. They discovered that Jamie, who everyone thought was just shy, actually felt words get stuck in her throat when too many people looked at her at once. They learned that Zeke, who was always fidgeting, could focus beautifully when allowed to hold something soft in his hands. Their teacher, Ms. Chen, noticed the change. One day, she joined their circle. "I've been watching," she said, "and I'm wondering if we could make our classroom work better for everyone." Together, the class brainstormed. They created quiet corners with soft pillows and noise-cancelling headphones for anyone who needed a break. They made a signal system for when someone felt overwhelmed. They took turns being sensory buddies, noticing when a classmate might need help navigating a loud assembly or a chaotic cafeteria. As weeks passed, something remarkable happened. The classroom became more peaceful. Children who had struggled began to thrive. Even those who had never needed an umbrella found they sometimes enjoyed the quiet corners. And one bright afternoon in late spring, as the children walked to the park for a class picnic, Alia noticed something different. Remy was walking beside her, squinting slightly in the sunlight, but his umbrella was folded and tucked under his arm. "The sun still feels loud," he told her when she asked, "but not as scary anymore. I know I have a safe place to go if I need it." Alia smiled. "Sometimes I still like using mine, though," she said, twirling her small red umbrella. "You helped me notice things I never saw before." Remy nodded. "Different isn't wrong," he said. "It's just different. Think together." Why did Remy carry his umbrella on sunny days? What was he actually trying to tell people? Why do you think it was hard for others to understand what Remy was experiencing? How did Alia's approach differ from how others treated Remy? What did she do that made a difference? What changed in the classroom once people started listening to each other's needs? Have you ever felt like Remy, experiencing something that others didn't seem to notice or understand? Do you know anyone who sees, hears, or feels the world differently than most people? How could you better understand their experience? Why might it be valuable to have people who experience the world differently in our communities? Philosophy Window, Laying and Listening Deeper. R.N.D. Laying, 1927 to 1989, was a Scottish psychiatrist and philosopher who had unusual ideas for his time. While most doctors were focused on fixing people who behaved or thought differently, Laying suggested something radical, perhaps what we call madness, or strange behaviour isn't always something broken. It might be a person's way of coping with a difficult world or expressing truths that others aren't ready to hear. Laing believed that when someone acts in ways we don't understand, our first response shouldn't be to try to change them, but rather to listen deeply to what they might be trying to communicate. He wrote, "Insanity is a perfectly rational adjustment to an insane world." By this, he meant that behaviours that seem odd might actually make perfect sense if we understood what that person was experiencing. For example, if Remy in our story had been seen by doctors in Laing's time, they might have simply labelled him as troublesome or attention-seeking. But Laing would have asked, "What is Remy's umbrella telling us? What truth is he expressing that we're not hearing?" Laing had three important insights that changed how many people think about differences in how minds work. Trust the person's experience. Even if someone's perceptions seem strange to us, they are real and valid to that person. Remy really did experience sunlight as loud. Look for the meaning. Unusual behaviours often have their own logic and purpose. Remy's umbrella wasn't just weird, it was a creative solution to his sensory challenges. Healing happens through genuine connection. Real help doesn't come from forcing people to act normal, but from creating safe spaces where all experiences can be shared and understood. Laing believed that many mental health struggles come from feeling disconnected from ourselves, from others, from meaning. He thought society often makes this worse by labelling some experiences as acceptable and others as crazy. We are all, in a certain sense, in touch with one another's madness, he wrote. We just forget to speak its language. By this, he meant that we all have moments of fear, confusion, or seeing the world in unique ways. When we remember this, we can connect with others across differences with compassion rather than judgment. Your turn, the other side of the umbrella. Materials needed: paper, folding ability, colouring supplies. Take a piece of paper and fold it in half. On one side, title it My Umbrella and draw or write about A. Time you felt misunderstood by others. What you were really feeling or experiencing inside. What you wished others had said or done to help you feel heard. How it felt to not be understood. On the other side, title it Their Umbrella and draw or write about a time when someone else seemed upset or acted in a way you didn't understand. What you thought at first. What might have been happening for them that you couldn't see. What you could do next time to understand them better. At the fold in the middle of your paper, draw an umbrella spanning both sides, symbolizing how understanding creates shelter and connection. At the bottom of the page, write, "Everyone's feelings deserve a safe space." Bonus activity with a trusted grown-up or friend. Practice asking these questions when someone seems upset or is acting in a way you don't understand. What's happening for you right now? How can I help? What do you need? Wonder more. R&D Laing believed that the first step toward healing, both for individuals and for communities, is listening. Not the kind of listening where we're just waiting for our turn to speak, but deep listening that seeks to understand another's experience, even when it's different from our own. This kind of listening requires courage. It asks us to step outside what feels familiar and comfortable. It invites us to consider that there might be ways of experiencing the world that we've never imagined. When Aaliyah asked Remy what it was like inside his head, she was practicing this brave kind of listening. She didn't try to correct him or change him. She simply created a space where his truth could be spoken and heard. And something powerful happened. Not only did Remy feel less alone, but Aaliyah's understanding of the world expanded. She discovered new ways of seeing and being that she might never have noticed otherwise. Perhaps this is one of the great gifts that comes from truly listening to those who experience the world differently. They can show us aspects of reality we've been missing. As Laing wrote, we can see other people's behavior, but not their experience. The only way to glimpse that experience is to ask, to listen, and to believe what we're told, even when, especially when, it differs from our own perspective. Today, many people who were once labeled as different or disordered are teaching us that neurological diversity, having many different kinds of minds, is natural and valuable. Just as biodiversity strengthens an ecosystem, having people who think, perceive, and respond differently strengthens our human community. Question to carry with you: who do you know that might need someone to hear their story? Not to fix it or change it, but simply to understand it. 9. What if I don't know the answer? Inspired by Michel de Montaigne. Michel de Montaigne, the original essayist, explored big questions by looking inward. He believed that by understanding ourselves, with all our messiness and curiosity, we could better understand the world. For kids, we can focus on thinking for yourself, being okay with not having all the answers, and learning by asking questions. Nico and the Notebook of Questions. Nico the fox was born with his eyes wide open and his mind even wider. Why is the sky blue but turns pink at sunset? He asked his mother when he was just a kit. Why do some animals hibernate while others don't? He wondered to his teacher, how can wind be invisible but strong enough to move trees? He asked the mailman. Nico's questions bubbled up constantly, like a spring that couldn't stop flowing. They appeared at breakfast. Why do we put milk on cereal? During math class, who decided numbers should go in this order? And just before bedtime, if dreams aren't real, why do they feel real while we're having them? Some grown-ups loved Nico's curiosity. His science teacher, Mr. Badger, would smile and say, "Let's find out together." His neighbour, Ms. Crane, would think carefully before responding. That's such an interesting way of looking at things. But others seemed bothered by his endless wonderings. Just stop asking so much, his uncle would sigh. Some things just are the way they are. We don't have time for all these questions, his busy older brother would grumble. You should know this already, his math teacher would say with a frown. Each time someone dismissed one of his questions, Nico felt a little pang in his chest. It was as if they were telling him that curiosity itself was somehow wrong. One rainy afternoon, while cleaning his room, Nico found an old notebook with a soft blue cover. The pages were blank and waiting. He sat on his bed, thinking, then picked up a pencil and wrote on the first page, "The Book of Maybes." Underneath, he began writing down all the questions that lived in his mind. Maybe why do ladybugs have spots? Maybe what makes thunder so loud? Maybe why do I feel shy sometimes and brave other times? Maybe are trees aware of birds nesting in them? Maybe why do some words feel jagged and others feel smooth? For weeks, Nico carried his book of maybes everywhere. Whenever a new question popped into his head, he'd quickly write it down. Sometimes he'd add little drawings or observations. The book became a safe place for his wonderings. They might not have answers yet, but at least they had somewhere to live. One sunny Saturday, Nico visited his grandmother, Grandma Luma. She was a wise old rabbit who lived in a cozy cottage at the edge of the meadow. Her home was filled with books, interesting rocks, pressed flowers, and curious objects she'd collected over her long life. As they sat drinking tea Nico's with extra honey, Grandma Luma noticed the blue notebook peeking out of Nico's backpack. "What's that you're carrying?" she asked. Nico hesitated. Would she also think his questions were too many, too silly, too much? "It's just my book of maybes," he said softly, passing it to her. Grandma Luma adjusted her spectacles and began to read, turning the pages slowly. Her expression changed from curiosity to delight, and then she laughed, a gentle, warm laugh that sounded like wind chimes. "This book is very special," she said, her eyes twinkling. "It means you're thinking, but I don't know the answers," Nico whispered, his ears drooping slightly. "I keep asking and asking, but I still don't know." "Neither do I," said Grandma Luma, surprising him. "And I'm very old, but maybe that's not the point." She led Nico outside to a big oak tree behind her cottage. They sat on a wooden bench beneath its spreading branches, the Book of Maybes open between them. "Let's look at this one," she said, pointing to his question about why leaves are green. "What do you think?" "Well," said Nico, "I know it has something to do with chlorophyll? "That's right," nodded Grandma. "But why is chlorophyll green? Why not purple or orange?" Nico's eyes widened. "I don't know." "Why? I'm not entirely sure either," she admitted. "Something about which wavelengths of light are absorbed and which are reflected. But that leads to another question. Why does light have different wavelengths in the first place?" For the next hour, they went through Nico's questions one by one. Some they tried to answer together, combining what they each knew. Some they just wondered about, imagining possibilities. And some they transformed into even better, deeper questions. "You know," said Grandma Luma, "some of the wisest animals I've ever known are the ones who keep their questions alive, even when answers seem far away." "Really?" asked Nico. "Absolutely. Answers can close doors in our minds, but good questions, they open doors we didn't even know were there." As the afternoon sun filtered through the oak leaves, creating patterns of light and shadow on the pages of his notebook, Nico felt something shift inside him. The questions that had sometimes made him feel small or bothersome suddenly seemed valuable, like treasures he was collecting. "I think," he said slowly, "that maybe not knowing is actually part of learning." Grandma Luma smiled and tapped her nose. "I think you just found an answer after all." When it was time to go home, Nico carefully put his book of maybes back in his backpack. But before closing it, he added a new line on the inside cover. Questions are doors. Not knowing is the key that opens them. Think together. Why did Nico start writing down his questions in the Book of Maybes? Why do you think some people told him to stop asking so many questions? How did Grandma Luma's view of questions differ from others in the story? Have you ever been afraid to ask a question because you thought you should already know the answer? Why might it sometimes be uncomfortable not to know something? Can you think of a time when not knowing an answer led you to discover something interesting? Nico wrote that questions are doors. Not knowing is the key that opens them. What do you think he meant by this? If you could ask any question without worrying about whether it sounds silly or too difficult, what would you ask? Philosophy Window, Montaigne, and the Power of Not Knowing. Michel de Montaigne, pronounced Montaigne, was a French philosopher who lived in the 16th century, a time when many educated people believed they should have firm answers about everything. Important men would debate loudly, each convinced they were absolutely right about how the world worked, what God wanted, or how people should live. But Montaigne took a different approach. Instead of claiming to know everything, he embraced not knowing. His favourite motto, written in Latin on a medal he carried, was "Qu'est-ce que j'ai?", which means, "What do I know?" Montaigne invented a new way of writing called the essay, from a French word meaning to try or to attempt. His essays weren't meant to give final answers, they were explorations, capturing his mind in the very act of thinking, wandering, questioning, and sometimes even contradicting itself. He wrote about everything: friendship, sadness, thumbs, smells, cannibals, coach rides, and even his cat. No topic was too small or too strange. By closely examining his own thoughts and experiences, Montaigne believed he could better understand what it means to be human. Here are some of Montaigne's key ideas. Look inward to understand outward by examining our own minds and experiences. Honestly, we learn about humanity as a whole. Embrace uncertainty. Not having all the answers isn't a weakness. It's the beginning of wisdom. Question everything. Even ideas that everyone knows should be examined with fresh eyes. Be kind to yourself. Montaigne believed we should accept our imperfections, physical and mental, with gentleness. Think for yourself. He encouraged people to form their own opinions rather than simply accepting what authorities said. Montaigne wrote, "Wonder is the foundation of all philosophy. Research is the means of all learning, and ignorance is the end." By this, he meant that staying curious and open to not knowing, like Nico with his Book of Maybes, keeps our minds alive and growing. In a world that often rewards quick, confident answers, Montaigne reminds us that sometimes the wisest response is simply, "I don't know. Let's think about it together." Your turn. What do I know? Materials needed? Paper? Stapler or string to bind pages? Colouring supplies. Create your own Book of Maybes, inspired by Montaigne's curious spirit and Nico's notebook. Make a small booklet by folding and stapling several sheets of paper, or by punching holes and tying pages together with string or ribbon. Design a cover with the title "My Book of Maybes," or create your own special title. Decorate it with images that represent curiosity to you, perhaps question marks, open doors, stars, or anything else that sparks wonder. On the inside cover, write, "I think, I wonder, I grow." For each page of your book, colon dot write one question you're genuinely curious about. It can be about anything: nature, feelings, space, dreams, friendship, or mysteries you've noticed. Below your question, write one thought or feeling you have about it. This doesn't have to be an answer. It could be a guess, a memory, or even just, "This makes me feel excited when I think about it." At the bottom of the page, write a new question that comes from your first one. For example, If your first question is, why do leaves change colour in fall? Your new question might be, do trees in tropical places, where seasons don't change, also transform in some way? Leave some blank pages at the end of your book for new questions that will surely arise. Bonus activity, choose one question from your book to explore more deeply. You might research it in a library book, ask different people what they think, or simply observe the world around you for clues. Add what you discover to your book, not as final answers, but as new threads of wondering. Wonder more. Michel de Montaigne believed that the journey of asking questions, even without finding definitive answers, helps us know ourselves and our world more deeply. He understood that the human mind is not a computer that needs to be filled with correct information, but a living, changing landscape full of meadows to explore, hills to climb, and rivers to follow. When we give ourselves permission not to know, paradoxically, we often discover more than if we had pretended certainty. Not knowing can be a kind of freedom, an open space where new ideas can grow. Montaigne lived in a time of religious conflicts and dogmatic thinking. People were literally fighting and dying over who had the right answers about God and the universe. Against this backdrop, his willingness to say I'm not sure or perhaps I'm wrong was not just philosophical, it was brave. Today, we live in a world where information moves incredibly fast, and it can sometimes feel like we should know everything immediately. Social media, search engines, and instant communication make it easy to find quick answers, but much harder to sit with meaningful questions. Yet, perhaps, like Nico, we need our books of maybes more than ever. We need spaces where questions can live and breathe and transform, where not knowing isn't failure but invitation. The next time you feel embarrassed for not knowing something or hesitate to ask a question that seems too big or too small, remember Montaigne's gentle wisdom. Remember that for thousands of years, the greatest thinkers have begun not with answers but with wonder. Question to carry with you. What's one question that's been living in your mind lately, waiting for the safe space to be asked? Disset. What can I inspired by Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor and a Stoic philosopher. He believed that we can't control everything that happens to us, but we can control how we respond. For kids, that translates beautifully into a story about calm in chaos, emotional resilience, and the power of our inner thoughts. The storm inside Milo. Milo the raccoon woke up with the sun, his whiskers twitching with excitement. He had planned the perfect day. First, he would build an amazing mud castle by the creek. Then, he would feast on the wild blueberries that grew on Bramble Hill. And finally, he would lie in his special spot in the meadow and watch cloud shapes until sunset. "This," he announced to his stuffed toy frog, "is going to be the best day ever." But as Milo scampered downstairs for breakfast, he heard his little brother Rory shouting with joy from the backyard. Curious, Milo peered out the window. There was Rory, splashing in the one mud puddle near their hollow, the perfect mud puddle Milo had been saving for his castle. "Rory," Milo called, rushing outside. "That was my mud. I was going to use it today." Rory looked up, his fur already coated in brown splotches. "But you were still sleeping," he said. "And Mom said it's going to dry up soon." Milo's tail twitched with frustration. "Now it's all ruined, all churned up and full of paw prints." His mother poked her head out from inside. "Milo, why don't you two play together? There's plenty of mud for both of you." But Milo didn't want to share his perfect plan. With a huff, he decided to skip ahead to step two, blueberry feast. "Fine," he muttered. "I'll just go to Bramble Hill instead." The walk to Bramble Hill usually took 15 minutes, but Milo was so grumpy that he kicked pine cones the whole way, making it take twice as long. By the time he reached the berry patch, the sun was high overhead. "At least no one can ruin berries," he said to himself, approaching his favourite bush. But as he reached for the first plump berry, he froze. The entire bush had been picked clean, with just a few squished berries left behind. Milo looked around and spotted a family of rabbits having a picnic nearby, their paws and mouths stained purple-blue. "Excuse me," Milo said, trying to sound polite despite his rising frustration. "Did you pick all the berries?" The father rabbit nodded cheerfully. "Early bird gets the worm, or in this case, the berries. There's a few left on that smaller bush, though." Milo trudged to the smaller bush, but the remaining berries were tiny and sour. His perfect feast was ruined. Two parts of his perfect day gone, but he still had Cloud watching. Nothing could possibly go wrong with clouds, right? With a heavy heart, Milo made his way to the meadow. His special spot was a flat rock that caught the afternoon sun just right. Not too hot, not too cool. He climbed up, lay back, and looked at the sky. The clouds were perfect today, big, fluffy, and white against a brilliant blue. Milo spotted what looked like an elephant, then a sailing ship, then something that might be a splat. A cold raindrop hit him right between the eyes. Then another, and another. Milo sat up in disbelief. The blue sky was rapidly disappearing behind dark grey clouds that had somehow snuck up from behind him. Within seconds, rain was pouring down, soaking his fur. "I hate today," he shouted, his tail puffed out like a bottle brush. "Nothing is going right. Everything is awful." As he stomped back toward home, getting wetter by the second, he passed the old pond where Tavi the turtle lived. Tavi was one of the oldest animals in the forest. Some said he was over 100 years old, though no one knew for sure. Even in the downpour, Tavi was sitting peacefully on a log at the pond's edge, rain bouncing off his shell. "Sounds like you're in quite a storm," Tavi said calmly as Milo splashed by. "It's not just me," Milo snapped, stopping to glare at the turtle. "It's everything. My brother took my mud. The rabbits ate all the berries, and now it's raining on the one day I wanted to watch clouds." Tavi nodded slowly. That is disappointing." "Disappointing? It's terrible." Milo kicked a puddle, sending water spraying. Tavi didn't flinch as the water hit his shell. Instead, he pointed to it with one wrinkled claw. "You know," he said thoughtfully, "I've lived a very long time. I've seen floods and droughts, blizzards and heat waves. I've had days when the fish wouldn't bite, and days when the sun was so hot my shell felt like an oven." Milo waited impatiently for the point of this story. "And what I've learned," Tavi continued, "is that I can't stop the rain from falling. I can't make the sun shine. I can't control whether the fish are hungry." He tapped his shell. "But I can choose what I carry inside. That I can control." Milo's brow furrowed. "What do you mean?" "Well," said Tavi, "right now you're carrying a storm inside. Anger, disappointment, frustration. The rain out here will stop eventually. But the storm inside? Only you decide how long that lasts." That night, curled in his dry, warm bed, Milo thought hard about what Tavi had said. Maybe he couldn't control whether there was mud available, or if berries were ripe, or if the sky decided to rain. Those things just happened. But maybe he could control something else. How he thought about these things, how he responded to them. The next morning dawned grey and drizzly. Rory looked glum at breakfast. "No playing outside today," he sighed. Milo looked out at the raindrops dancing on puddles. Suddenly, he had an idea. "Who says?" he replied with a grin. "I bet those puddles are perfect for splashing." After breakfast, the two raccoon brothers put on their rain boots and spent the morning jumping in every puddle they could find. They discovered that the mud by the creek, now even wetter than before, was perfect for slippery mudsliding. Later, they found a few blackberry bushes that the rabbits had missed and though the berries were smaller than blueberries, they were sweet and juicy. And that afternoon, when the rain finally stopped, Milo and Rory lay on their backs in the wet grass and watched as the clouds broke apart, creating shapes even more fantastic than usual because of how they caught the light after the storm. As they walked home at sunset, Rory said, "This was the best day ever." Milo smiled, remembering his words from yesterday. "You know what? It really was. Think together." Why was Milo so upset by the changes to his plans? Have you ever felt similar frustration? What did Tavi mean when he talked about what I carry inside? What was Milo carrying inside at first? How did Milo's attitude change from the first day to the second? What stayed the same and what was different? Do you think Milo could have had a good first day if he had responded differently? Why or why not? Can we choose how we respond when things don't go according to plan? Is it easy or difficult? What do you typically do when something disappoints you or makes you angry? Can controlling our thoughts and responses make us happier? How? What's the difference between changing an outside situation and changing your perspective on it? Philosophy Window, Marcus Aurelius and the Calm Within. Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor who lived almost 2,000 years ago. As emperor, he was one of the most powerful people in the world at that time, commanding armies, making laws, and ruling an empire that stretched across Europe, parts of Africa, and the Middle East. Yet despite all his power, Marcus Aurelius couldn't control everything. He faced wars, plagues, rebellions, family troubles, and his own illnesses. He experienced grief, frustration, and worry, just like all humans do. What made Marcus special wasn't his crown or his armies. It was how he thought about life's challenges. Each night, Marcus wrote private notes to himself, reminders about how to stay calm, fair, and kind, no matter what problems he faced. These notes were never meant to be published, but fortunately for us, they survived as a book called Meditations, one of the most important works of Stoic philosophy. Stoicism was a school of thought that taught people how to find inner peace and strength, even in difficult times. Here are some of Marcus Aurelius's key ideas. Focus on what you can control. Marcus believed we waste energy worrying about things beyond our power. Instead, we should focus on what we can control. Our thoughts, choices, and actions. Accept what happens. Life doesn't always go as planned. Rather than fighting against reality, Marcus suggested accepting what happens and responding wisely. "Your thoughts create your experience," Marcus wrote. "The happiness of your life depends upon the quality of your thoughts." He believed that how we think about events matters more than the events themselves. Practice gratitude. Even on hard days, Marcus reminded himself to appreciate good things, however small. Remember what matters. Marcus often reflected on what was truly important, being kind, fair, and helpful to others. One of his most famous quotes is, "You have power over your mind, not outside events. Realize this, and you will find strength." This is exactly what Milo learned from Tavi the Turtle. We can't always control whether it rains or if someone else uses the mud puddle first. But we can control our perspective, our attitude, and how we choose to respond. Your turn. My circle of control. Materials needed. Paper. Drawing compass or round object to trace. Colouring supplies. The Stoics, like Marcus Aurelius, often used a simple but powerful exercise to help focus their minds on what they could and couldn't control. Let's try our own version. Draw two circles on your paper, one inside the other, creating a smaller circle inside a larger one. Label the inner circle, things I can control. Label the outer ring, the space between the two circles, things I cannot control. Inside the inner circle, write or draw things that are within your power to control, such as colon dot your thoughts and attitude, your words and actions, how you respond to feelings, how you treat others, how much effort you give, your choices. In the outer ring, write or draw things that are beyond your direct control, such as the weather, other people's choices, unexpected events, the past, whether you win or lose, how others feel about you. Using your brightest favorite colors, decorate the inner circle. Make it bold and vibrant. At the bottom of your page, write, "This is where my power lives." Bonus activity for 1 week, when something frustrating happens, practice pausing and asking yourself, "Is this something in my inner circle or my outer ring?" If it's in the outer ring, beyond your control, try taking a deep breath and focusing on how you want to respond, which is in your inner circle. Wonder more. Marcus Aurelius believed that calm minds create strong people. This doesn't mean never feeling upset or angry. Even Marcus, with all his wisdom, felt these emotions. Rather, it means developing the ability to pause between what happens to us and how we respond. In that pause, that small, powerful moment, lies our freedom. When Milo first experienced his disappointing day, he reacted immediately with anger and frustration. There was no pause, no choice, just reaction. But after talking with Tavi and thinking about his day, Milo created a pause. In that space, he found the power to choose a different response when faced with rainy weather the next day. The Stoics believed this practice of focusing on what we can control and accepting what we cannot leads not just to calmer days, but to a more meaningful life. Instead of spending our energy fighting against reality or wishing things were different, we can direct that energy toward responding wisely and finding opportunities even in difficulties. Marcus wrote in his journal, "Our life is what our thoughts make it." This simple idea contains profound wisdom. The same event, like a rainy day, can be experienced as a disaster or an adventure, depending on our thoughts about it. This doesn't mean pretending everything is perfect when it's not. Marcus faced many genuine hardships, but he found that even in difficult circumstances, our inner response remains our choice. The next time you face a disappointment or a change of plans, remember Milo and his storm. Remember Marcus and his journal. And remember that inside you lives the power to choose how you respond. A small power, perhaps, but one that can transform your experience of even the stormiest days. Question to carry with you: what's one thing you can control, even when everything else feels unpredictable? Chednacht, what if life doesn't make sense? Inspired by Albert Camus, for kids, we can explore Albert Camus' central idea through the lens of making meaning, even when life feels confusing or unfair. Instead of giving up, Camus invites us to create our own joy, our own purpose, even in the middle of absurd or difficult situations. The girl who rolled the boulder. Every morning, Luma the badger would wake up just before sunrise. She'd stretch, wash her face in the stream, and prepare for what she knew was waiting. And there it always was, a massive grey boulder, somehow returned overnight to block the entrance to her garden. The boulder was twice her size, perfectly round, and mysteriously determined to be exactly where she didn't want it. The first time it appeared, months ago, Luma had been confused. "How did this get here?" she wondered aloud, circling it with concern. She spent that entire day pushing with all her strength, her paws digging into the soft earth, her breath coming in quick gasps. By sunset, she had rolled the boulder away from her garden gate, down a small hill, and into a meadow where it couldn't block anything. "There," she had said proudly, wiping sweat from her brow. Problem solved. But the next morning, the boulder was back, in exactly the same spot. Luma was baffled. She pushed it away again. And again, it returned by morning. Day after day, the pattern continued. The boulder would appear, Luma would spend hours moving it, and somehow in the night it would return. No one ever saw how it happened. After 2 weeks of this strange ritual, the forest animals began to whisper. "Poor Luma," said the rabbits, shaking their heads. "So stubborn." "Why bother?" asked the squirrels, watching from the trees. "It's completely pointless." "You're wasting your time," warned the fox. "You should move somewhere else." Luma heard their comments. Sometimes, pushing the heavy stone until her muscles ached, she even wondered if they were right. Was this all for nothing? Should she give up? But each time these thoughts arose, Luma noticed something interesting. Despite the struggle, despite the repetition, she didn't feel sad. In fact, there were moments during her daily task when she felt strangely alive. "I like the way the early sun feels warm on my back when I push," she realized one day. "I like the satisfying crunch of the earth under my paws. I like the feeling of trying, of not giving up." So Luma kept pushing, but she began to change her approach. Instead of resenting the boulder, she became curious about her relationship with it. One morning, she brought her small wooden flute and played tunes between pushing efforts. The music seemed to make the boulder lighter somehow. Another day, she brought paints and decorated the stone with colourful flowers and swirling patterns. "If you're going to visit every day," she told it, "you might as well be beautiful." She began to notice things she'd missed before, how the boulder had tiny sparkles of quartz that caught the light, how different sides of it had different textures, how the path she created by rolling it each day was now lined with interesting plants that grew nowhere else. Sometimes she'd take breaks during her pushing to dance around the boulder, just because it felt good to move her body freely after the strain. Other days she'd sit on top of it to watch the sunset before rolling it away. The boulder still returned every morning. That hadn't changed. But Luma had. One day, Lily the mouse timidly approached as Luma was painting a new design on the boulder. "Can I help?" she asked. Luma smiled. "Of course." Soon, Lily was coming every day. Not to help move the boulder, she was far too small for that, but to play music while Luma pushed, or to add her own tiny painted details to their growing masterpiece. Then Ben the beaver joined them, bringing snacks to share during rest breaks. Owl started coming to read poems aloud as Luma worked. Even the skeptical squirrels eventually joined their daily gathering. None of them could explain the boulder's mysterious return each morning. None of them could make Luma's task any less difficult. But somehow, their presence made the absurdity of it all feel less lonely, more like a shared adventure. "I still don't understand why you bother," said Fox, who sometimes watched from a distance. "The boulder always comes back. Nothing ever changes." Luma looked around at her friends, at the path worn smooth by hundreds of days of effort, at the beautiful patterns that now covered the once plain stone. "Maybe the boulder doesn't change," she replied, "but everything else has." And the next morning, as always, she woke up early, washed her face in the stream, and prepared to face her boulder, not because she expected different results, but because, in the pushing itself, she had found something worth waking up for. Thinked together. Why did Luma keep pushing the boulder every day, even when it always came back? How did Luma's feelings about the boulder change over time? What caused this shift? What do you think the other animals learn from watching Luma? Why do you think Luma found joy in what others saw as pointless? Have you ever done something difficult just because it mattered to you, even if others didn't understand? Do you think it's better to avoid challenges that seem impossible or to face them anyway? Why? How did Luma create meaning and community around her daily task? If you knew a task would never be finished, could it still be worthwhile? How? Philosophy Window, Camus and the Joyful Rebel. Albert Camus, pronounced Albert Camus, was a philosopher born in Algeria in 1913. As a young man, he lived through World War II, a time when many people were questioning whether life had any meaning at all in the face of so much suffering and chaos. During this dark period, Camus developed a powerful idea. Perhaps the universe itself doesn't provide us with clear meaning or purpose, but that doesn't mean we can't create meaning ourselves. Camus explored what he called the absurd, the gap between our human desire for meaning, clarity, and purpose, and a world that often seems random, confusing, or indifferent to our struggles. He wondered, how should we live when life doesn't make perfect sense? To explain his philosophy, Camus retold an ancient Greek myth about a man named Sisyphus, who was punished by the gods. Sisyphus had to push a huge boulder up a mountain every day, only to watch it roll back down each night, forcing him to start over the next morning, forever. Most people would see Sisyphus's fate as tragic, but Camus suggested something revolutionary. What if Sisyphus found meaning and even joy in his endless task? What if, knowing the boulder would always roll back down, he pushed it anyway and found satisfaction in the effort itself? This is what made Camus special among philosophers. Instead of despair in the face of life's absurdity, he proposed rebellion through joy and engagement. Accept reality as it is, acknowledge when situations seem meaningless or unfair, without pretending otherwise. Choose to engage fully anyway, commit to living with passion and presence, even when there's no guarantee of success or purpose. Create your own meaning. Find value in the experiences, connections, and choices that matter to you personally. Embrace joy as rebellion. When life seems absurd, choosing happiness becomes a kind of beautiful defiance. Camus wrote, "The struggle itself toward the heights is enough to fill a person's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy." In our story, Luma is like Sisyphus. She knows the boulder will return, but she chooses to push it anyway. More importantly, she discovers that meaning isn't found in solving the boulder problem once and for all. It's found in how she approaches the challenge, the community she builds around it, and the person she becomes through the struggle. Your turn, my boulder, my joy. Materials needed, paper, colouring supplies. We all face boulders in our lives, challenges that might seem pointless, confusing, or unfair, but like Luma and Sisyphus, we can choose how we respond to these challenges. Draw a hill or mountain on your paper. Make it large enough to fill most of the page. At the bottom of the hill, draw a boulder. Inside or next to this boulder, write or draw something in your life that sometimes feels hard, unfair, or doesn't make sense. This could be a difficult situation you can't change, a challenge you face again and again, something you don't understand but must deal with, a task that never seems finished. Starting from the boulder, draw a path winding up the hill. Along this path, write or draw things that help you keep going despite difficulties. Activities that bring you joy, like Luma's music and painting. People who support you, like Luma's friends. Small moments of beauty you notice along the way. Qualities inside yourself that give you strength, courage, curiosity, kindness. Ways you've grown through facing challenges. At the top of the hill, create a small, special space. This represents your perspective, the view you can only see after climbing. In this space, write, "This is my life, and I choose how to live it." Around your hill, add colours, patterns, or images that represent the beauty you create through your choices, even when facing your boulder. Bonus activity, for 1 week, when you face something frustrating or seemingly pointless, pause and ask, how would Luma approach this? Then try adding one small element of creativity, joy, or meaning to the situation. Wonder more. Albert Camus believed we face a choice when life doesn't make sense. We can either turn away from the confusion or we can turn toward it with open eyes and rebellious hearts. The word rebellion might make you think of loud protests or dramatic actions. But Camus saw that the most powerful rebellion is often quieter. It happens inside us when we choose to create meaning rather than just accepting meaninglessness. Think about Luma. Her rebellion wasn't refusing to push the boulder that would have just left it blocking her garden. Her rebellion was changing her relationship with the boulder, finding joy in the struggle, and creating beauty where others saw only pointlessness. This is what Camus called lucid rebellion, facing reality clearly while still choosing engagement and joy. We all experience moments when life seems unfair or confusing. Perhaps you've practiced for something but still didn't succeed. Maybe you've faced a problem that keeps returning no matter what you do. Or perhaps you've wondered why certain difficult things happen at all. In these moments, Camus would say, you have power. Not necessarily the power to change everything around you, but the power to choose how you respond, what you notice, what you create, and how you connect with others along the way. As Camus wrote, in the midst of winter, I found there was, within me, an invincible summer. Your invincible summer is your capacity to find meaning and joy even in the middle of life's winters, not because everything makes perfect sense, but because you choose to live fully despite the absurdity. Question to carry with you, what's one thing you do? Not because it's easy or guaranteed to succeed, but because it matters to you and makes you feel alive. Dvanact, do I really need all that? Inspired by Diogenes. Diogenes is a fantastically odd and fun philosopher to include, especially for kids. He challenged the world by being boldly honest, simple, and silly. Diogenes asked, what do we really need to be happy? And why do people pretend so much? He lived in a barrel, barked at people, and carried a lantern around in daylight looking for an honest person. For children, we can shape this into a story about honesty, simplicity, and laughing at things that don't make sense. The dog who said, no thanks. In the shiny city of Twinkleton, everything glittered. The buildings sparkled with gold trim. The sidewalks were polished until they gleamed. Even the trees were decorated with tiny bells that tinkled in the breeze. And just like their city, the animals of Twinkleton loved to shine. Rabbits wore diamond-studded collars. Squirrels carried acorns in silver pouches. Raccoons dyed their fur with rainbow colors to stand out. Everyone in Twinkleton wanted more. More toys, more snacks, more sparkles, more stuff. The stores were always crowded with animals buying things they'd show off for a day, then forget about by tomorrow. Everyone, that is, except for one dog. His name was Dio, and he lived in a large wooden barrel by the river. The barrel had originally held apple cider, and on warm days, it still smelled sweetly of fruit. Dio had rolled it onto its side and lined it with soft moss. From its round opening, he could see the sunrise each morning and count stars each night. Dio owned almost nothing. No gadgets, no shoes, no sparkly collar, no fluffy pillows. Sometimes he borrowed a bowl to drink water, but he usually returned it the same day. The other animals couldn't understand him at all. Why don't you want a golden leash like mine? Asked Pierre the poodle, showing off his new accessory. Or a proper house? Asked Martha the mole, who had just installed her third underground swimming pool. Dio just wagged his tail and stretched out in a patch of sunshine. I already have the sun to warm me, he said, the breeze to cool me, and belly laughs to fill me up. What else do I need? But don't you want to be important? Asked Oliver the owl, adjusting his designer eyeglasses, which he didn't actually need for seeing. Dio scratched his ear thoughtfully. I'm already exactly as important as I need to be, he replied. Same as you, same as the ants, same as the clouds. The animals of Twinkleton thought Dio was very strange. When he walked through town, he sniffed at their elaborate gardens and sometimes laughed out loud at the things they bought. If he saw someone being fake nice or pretending to like something just to fit in, he would make a loud woof that made everyone jump. "That dog has no manners," they whispered. "And no ambition," others added. But secretly, some of them were curious about Dio. He seemed so free. One day, Mayor Peacock decided to throw a grand gala, the fanciest party Twinkleton had ever seen. Everyone who was anyone would be there, showing off their newest possessions and most expensive outfits. To everyone's surprise, the mayor sent Dio an invitation. Some thought it was a joke. Others assumed the mayor wanted to teach the simple dog a lesson about proper society. On the night of the party, animals arrived in carriages pulled by fireflies. They wore their stiffest clothes and most uncomfortable shoes. They practiced their polite laughs and memorized impressive things to say. Dio arrived exactly as he was, fur a bit messy from his afternoon swim in the river, carrying nothing but a lantern he'd made from a hollow gourd. "What's that for?" asked Mayor Peacock, eyeing the lantern with suspicion. "It's not even dark in here." "I'm looking for something," Dio replied with a wink. Inside the mayor's mansion, tables were piled high with elaborate foods that looked too pretty to eat. Animals stood around talking about their vacations and their collections and their children's achievements. When dinner was served, everyone used tiny forks and followed complicated rules about which spoon to use when. Dio watched with interest for a moment, then simply picked up his soup bowl and slurped directly from it, making a loud, appreciative sound. The room fell silent. Mayor Peacock's feathers ruffled with embarrassment. "My dear fellow," he said stiffly, "that is not how we eat soup in Twinkleton." Dio looked around at the other animals, their necks craned awkwardly, as they tried to scoop soup while keeping their fancy outfits clean. "But why use a spoon when the bowl works better?" he asked. "And why are we all wearing these itchy shoes when the grass feels so much better between our toes?" He kicked off the one shoe someone had convinced him to wear and wiggled his paws happily. "And most importantly," Dio continued, holding up his lantern, "why do we pretend to be so different from what we really are? I've been looking everywhere for someone who's just being themselves." There was an uncomfortable silence. Some animals looked offended. Some looked confused. But then, a tiny voice spoke up. "He's right about the shoes," said Lily the leopard cub, kicking off her sparkly sandals. "These hurt my feet. And I don't actually like caviar," admitted Bernard the beaver, pushing away his plate. "I've just been pretending because everyone says it's fancy." Slowly, remarkably, a change came over the room. Several animals removed their uncomfortable shoes. Someone laughed. A real laugh, not a polite one. Two old friends who had been bragging about their vacations started talking about the books they'd really enjoyed instead. Mayor Peacock watched in horror as his perfect party transformed into something much messier, louder, and more genuine. "You've ruined everything," he hissed at Dio. Dio wagged his tail. "Or maybe I fixed it." By the end of the night, a small group of animals had gathered around Dio, asking questions about his barrel home and his simple life. He answered honestly, sometimes making them laugh, sometimes making them think. As he walked home under the stars, Dio smiled to himself. His barrel would still be there, just as comfortable as any mansion. The moon would still shine, more beautiful than any jewel. And tomorrow would bring new chances to be exactly, honestly himself. What else could anyone think together? Why did Dio choose to live in a barrel instead of a fancy house like the other animals in Twinkleton? What did Dio mean when he said, "What else do I need?" Do you think he was really missing out on important things? Why did Dio bring a lantern to the party? What was he looking for? Have you ever felt like having less stuff made you feel more free? What was that like? Why do you think people sometimes try to look more important or fancy than they really are? At the party, some animals started being more honest after Dio spoke up. Why do you think that was hard for them at first? Is there something you do just because everyone else does, even though it doesn't make much sense to you? What's the difference between things we truly need and things we just want because others have them? Philosophy Window, Diogenes, and the Honest Life. Diogenes was one of history's strangest and most fascinating philosophers. Born in Greece around 404 BCE, he rejected almost everything that society valued: money, possessions, power, reputation, and even basic manners. While other philosophers talked about simple living, Diogenes actually lived it in the most extreme way. He made his home in a large ceramic jar, sometimes called a barrel or tub, in the marketplace of Athens. He owned a cloak, a walking stick, and a small bowl for eating and drinking. When he saw a child drinking water using just his hands, Diogenes threw away even his bowl, saying, "A child has beaten me in simplicity." Diogenes founded a school of philosophy called Cynicism, which comes from the Greek word for dog-like. He earned this name because he acted like a dog in several ways. He lived outdoors. He ate, slept, and even went to the bathroom in public. He was brutally honest, with no filter. He was loyal to his principles. He could tell true friends from false ones. While his behavior shocked many people, Diogenes had profound reasons for acting this way. He believed that most human customs are artificial and unnecessary. Why follow rules that don't make sense? Nature provides everything we truly need. Sunlight, fresh air, simple food, and freedom are the real sources of happiness. Truth matters more than politeness. Diogenes would rather be honest than make others comfortable with pleasant lies. Actions speak louder than words. Instead of just talking about philosophy, he lived his beliefs, even when it was difficult. Diogenes was famous for carrying a lit lantern in broad daylight, claiming he was looking for an honest person. When powerful people visited him, expecting respect, he often ignored them or made fun of their self-importance. The most famous story about Diogenes involves Alexander the Great, the most powerful ruler in the world at that time. Alexander sought out Diogenes, who was sunbathing, and stood over him asking if there was any favor he could do for the philosopher. Diogenes replied, "Yes, stand out of my sunlight." Instead of being offended, Alexander was impressed, later saying, "If I were not Alexander, I would wish to be Diogenes." Diogenes taught that happiness comes not from having more, but from needing less. He showed that true freedom isn't about having choices between many possessions, but about being liberated from wanting those possessions in the first place. His challenging questions still make us think today. Do I really need this? Is this real or just for show? What happens when I tell the truth, even if it's weird? Am I living according to nature or according to society's expectations? Your turn, what could I let go of? Materials needed, paper, colouring supplies. Diogenes believed that possessions and social expectations weigh us down and keep us from being free. Let's explore what we truly need versus what might be holding us back. Draw a backpack or bag in the centre of your paper. Make it large enough to write inside. Inside your backpack, write or draw the things you really need to feel good, physical. Needs, like water, food, rest, movement. Emotional needs, like laughter, hugs, quiet time. Connection needs like friends, family, pets. Mind needs like stories, questions, imagination. Around the outside of your backpack, write or draw at least three things you might be able to let go of that could be weighing you down unnecessarily. Material things, like toys you don't play with anymore. Habits, like spending too much time on screens. Worries, like trying to impress others. Expectations, like thinking you need to be perfect. Now, draw yourself holding the backpack. Are you struggling under its weight or carrying it easily? At the bottom of your page, write, "Freedom feels light." Bonus activity, for 1 week, try a Diogenes day where you use only what you truly need. Maybe go for a walk without bringing any devices, eat a simple meal without fancy dishes, or spend time with friends doing something that costs nothing. Notice how it feels to need less. Wonder more. Diogenes believed that being yourself, fully and honestly, is better than trying to impress others. While most of us wouldn't want to live exactly as he did in a barrel, without privacy or possessions, his radical approach to life still offers wisdom that can lighten our steps. In today's world, we're constantly shown images of things we should want, the newest gadgets, the trendiest clothes, the most picture-perfect experiences. Social media can make us feel like we're always missing out on something better. Advertisements tell us we need more, more, more to be happy. Diogenes would look at all this and probably laugh out loud. He might hold up his lantern to these messages and ask, "But is any of this real? Does it bring true joy?" The cynics believe that happiness comes not from changing the world to fit our desires, but from changing our desires to match what's natural and necessary. When we strip away the unnecessary, the pretending, the excess, the keeping up with others, we often discover a simpler kind of contentment waiting underneath. This doesn't mean we can't enjoy beautiful things or fun experiences, but it invites us to ask, "Am I enjoying this because it truly brings me joy, or because I think it makes me look good to others? Am I being honest about who I am, or am I putting on a show?" Like Dio in our story, we might find that being genuine, even when it goes against what everyone else is doing, creates a special kind of freedom. And sometimes, our honesty might even help others find the courage to be more real themselves. What would happen if, just for today, you were completely, honestly yourself, without trying to impress anyone? What if, like Diogenes with his lantern, you looked for what's genuine in yourself and others? Question to carry with you: what's something you can do this week that's simple, honest, and completely you? Not for show, not to impress, but just because it brings true joy. Trinact: how do we live well together? Inspired by Confucius. Confucius focused on kindness, respect, and harmony. He believed a good life comes from treating others well, learning from elders, and improving ourselves day by day. For kids, his ideas shine through manners with meaning, empathy, and leading by example. The missing chopstick. The village of Willow Grove sat nestled between gentle hills where cherry trees bloomed pink in spring and turned fiery red in autumn. For hundreds of years, the villagers had celebrated the arrival of spring with a special gathering called the Spring Dinner. Every family contributed something: sweet dumplings, fragrant rice, steamed vegetables from the first harvest. Tables would be arranged in the village square, forming one enormous circle where everyone could see each other's faces as they shared the meal together. This year, May's family was hosting the central table, a special honour. May, her parents, her little brother Lynn, and her grandfather had spent days preparing. They polished the family's wooden table until it gleamed. They practiced their traditional songs. Most importantly, they brought out their treasured set of bamboo chopsticks, handed down through 5 generations. Each pair of chopsticks had been carefully carved and painted with tiny plum blossoms. Grandfather said they carried the stories of all who had used them before. On the morning of the spring dinner, excitement filled their small house. May helped her mother arrange fresh flowers, while Lynn followed Grandfather around, asking endless questions about previous celebrations. Will there be lanterns? Will we stay up all night? Can I sit next to you? Lin bounced on his toes, nearly knocking over a vase of cherry blossoms. Careful, little one, Grandfather said gently, steadying the vase. Remember what I taught you about moving mindfully in a shared space. Lin immediately slowed his movements. Like a leaf on still water, he recited, making Grandfather smile. As the sun began to set, villagers gathered in the square. Delicious smells filled the air, along with laughter and greetings. May's family took their place at the central table, which had been decorated with spring flowers and candles. Just as everyone was about to begin eating, May heard a small gasp beside her. Lin was staring down at his place setting, his bottom lip beginning to tremble. "What's wrong?" May whispered. "My chopsticks," Lin said quietly. "There's only one. The other one is missing." May looked around. The meal was about to begin. Everyone was settling into their seats, and her parents were busy greeting the village elders at the far end of the table. There wasn't time to search for the missing chopstick or find a replacement. Lin's eyes filled with tears. "Oh, no, I can't eat with just one," he pouted, loud enough that a few nearby people glanced over. May could have ignored him. She could have grabbed her own pair of chopsticks and enjoyed the meal, leaving Lin to figure it out or wait for their parents to notice. After all, it wasn't her problem. But instead, May reached for her own pair of beautifully painted chopsticks. She separated them and placed one in Lin's hand. "Here," she said softly. "You take one of mine. We'll each have one, and we can eat slower, together." Lin looked at her with surprise, his tears forgotten. "But how will that work?" "We'll have to be patient," May said, demonstrating how to scoop a small bite with just one chopstick. "See? It's like a little spoon." The children giggled as they awkwardly maneuvered their single chopsticks, carefully taking small bites of rice and vegetables. What could have been a moment of frustration became a quiet game between them. Grandfather, who had been watching silently, leaned over with a warm smile. "You showed Li just now, May." "Li?" she asked, chewing carefully on a bite of dumpling. "Yes, Li," Grandfather nodded. "It means showing respect through small actions that bring peace. When you shared your chopstick, you chose harmony over convenience. That is Li." May thought about this as the meal continued. She hadn't known there was a special word for what she'd done. She had simply wanted to help her brother and avoid disrupting the meal for everyone. The next morning, as May and Lin walked to school, they passed old Mrs. Chen struggling to carry a basket of vegetables up the hill. "Wait," Lin said, surprising May by stopping. He ran over to Mrs. Chen. "May I help you carry that, please?" Mrs. Chen's weathered face broke into a smile as Lin took one handle of the heavy basket, lightening her load. "I used my Li," he whispered to May as they continued their walk after helping Mrs. Chen to her door. In the days that followed, May noticed small changes throughout Willow Grove. When Zhang Wei accidentally knocked over Li Jun's carefully arranged display of carved figurines at the market, instead of getting angry, Li Jun calmly helped pick them up. "Accidents happen," he said simply. When the village children were choosing teams for their bamboo stick game, Ying, who was usually picked last, was invited first by the team captain, who had noticed her sitting alone. Even May's teacher changed his approach. Rather than scolding students who made mistakes, he began asking, "What can we learn from this?" It seemed that one small moment, a shared chopstick, had started something. The village hadn't changed dramatically. There were still disagreements and difficulties, but more and more, people were pausing before reacting, choosing actions that created harmony rather than discord. At dinner one evening, May told her grandfather about all she had observed. "Isn't it amazing," she said, "how one little chopstick could change so much?" Grandfather smiled, his eyes crinkling at the corners. The chopstick itself changed nothing, he said gently. It was your choice to create peace rather than frustration that made the difference. And such choices, when others see them, plant seeds for more choices just like them. May looked down at her chopsticks, seeing them differently now, not just as tools for eating, but as reminders of the small, daily choices that could build a world of harmony, one respectful action at a time. Think together. Why did May offer one of her chopsticks to Lynn? What might have happened if she hadn't? What did Grandfather mean by the word Lee? How is it different from just following rules? Why do you think Lynn decided to help Mrs. Chen the next day? Have you ever seen how one kind action can lead to others? What happened? Can small actions and choices really change how people feel and behave around each other? If someone is upset or angry, how might principles like Lee help the situation? What are some ways we show respect without using words? Think about your family, classroom, or neighborhood. What's one thing that helps everyone live well together? Philosophy Window, Confucius, and the Harmony Way. Confucius, 551 to 479 BCE, was a wise teacher who lived in ancient China during a time of great change and conflict. Born when his country was divided into competing states, often at war with each other, Confucius dreamed of a world where people could live together in peace and harmony. Unlike some philosophers who went away to mountaintops to think alone, Confucius travelled from village to village, teaching anyone who wanted to learn, from farmers to princes. He believed that wisdom should be practical and useful in everyday life. At the heart of Confucius's teachings was a simple but powerful idea. A good society begins with good individuals who treat each other with kindness and respect. Rather than focusing on complicated theories or religious rituals, he emphasized how we should behave toward one another in our daily lives. Here are some of Confucius's core teachings. Li, often translated as ritual or propriety, Li means more than just manners or rules. It represents thoughtful actions that show respect and create harmony. When you hold a door for someone, wait your turn to speak, or bow to an elder, you're practicing lithium. Ren, this means benevolence or humaneness, treating others with kindness and compassion. Confucius believed that Ren is natural to humans, but needs to be cultivated through practice and reflection. Junzi, this describes the superior person or person of noble character who serves as a model for others. A Junzi is not perfect, but continuously works to improve themselves and help others. Shao, this means filial piety or respect for parents, elders, and ancestors. Confucius taught that honoring those who came before us creates a foundation for all other virtues. Zhongyong, the doctrine of the mean, which teaches moderation and balance in all things, avoiding extremes and finding the middle path. One of Confucius's most famous teachings is what we now call the Golden Rule, which he expressed negatively: do not impose on others what you yourself do not desire. This reminds us to consider how our actions affect others before we act. Confucius also believed strongly in the power of example. He said, if you want to establish order in the world, first establish order in your state. If you want to establish order in your state, first establish harmony in your family. If you want to establish harmony in your family, first cultivate virtue in yourself. In this way, Confucius showed that even the largest problems, like creating peace in the world, begin with the smallest actions of individuals choosing to be kind, respectful, and thoughtful in their daily interactions. Your turn. A week of Li. Materials needed. Paper. Colouring supplies. Time for reflection. Confucius believed that small actions of respect and kindness, practiced consistently, can transform how we live together. Let's create a kindness calendar to practice Li for 1 week. Create a 7-day calendar on your paper. You can make it any shape you like, perhaps a circle to represent harmony, or a tree with 7 branches to show how good actions help us grow. At the top of your calendar, write Lee Practice Small Actions for Harmony. For each day of the week, choose one specific action of Lee that you can practice. Here are some ideas to get you started. Monday, let someone else go first. In line, in a game, or in conversation Tuesday, thank someone who helps you, especially people whose work is often taken for granted Wednesday. Help quietly without being asked or expecting recognition Thursday. Speak gently when you feel upset or frustrated Friday. Really listen when someone is talking without interrupting Saturday. Take extra care of something shared. A classroom space, a toy, or a book Sunday. Show respect to someone of a different age, background, or opinion than yours. Each evening, take a moment to reflect on your practice of Lee that day, colon, dot, were. You able to complete your chosen action? How did it feel to practice Lee? Did you notice any changes in yourself or those around you? At the end of the week, right at the bottom of your calendar, harmony begins with me. Bonus activity, share your experience with family members or classmates. What did everyone learn? Could you create a family or classroom harmony practice based on what worked best? Wonder more. Confucius believed that peace and harmony grow from respect and kindness, just like a forest grows from tiny seeds. His vision wasn't of a perfect world without problems, but of people who respond to life's challenges with wisdom, patience, and consideration for others. What makes Confucius's teachings special is that they're not just about big ideas. They're about small, everyday moments. The way you greet your neighbor, how you react when someone makes a mistake, whether you take a moment to help someone struggling, these small choices might seem unimportant on their own. But Confucius understood that they add up over time, creating either harmony or discord in our shared spaces. Like ripples spreading from a single pebble dropped in water, our actions influence those around us in ways we might not even realize. Think about spaces where you spend time. Your home, your classroom, your community. Where do you see examples of Lee in action? Where might more Lee help create greater harmony? Remember that practicing Lee doesn't mean being perfect or never having difficult feelings. Even Confucius admitted that he made mistakes and had to keep working on himself throughout his life. What matters is the intention and effort to consider others and create peace rather than conflict. As you go through your day, you might find it helpful to pause sometimes and ask, what would create more harmony in this moment? Often, the answer will be something small, a patient word, a helping hand, a moment of careful listening. Confucius would say these small moments are not small at all. They are the very building blocks of a good life and a better world. Question to carry with you, what's one small act you could do today to help someone feel seen and respected? See to your act. Can two opposites be true? Inspired by Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Hegel is complex, even for grown-ups. But for kids, we can draw out a simple, powerful idea from his philosophy. We grow by wrestling with opposites. Learning doesn't come from easy answers. It comes from challenge, change, and putting pieces together into something new. In Hegel's world, thinking deeply is like going on a journey, where every idea leads to its opposite, and then to something even bigger, the bridge between yes and no. Nina and Theo, two young squirrel siblings, had been saving acorns all winter for one special project, their very own treehouse. They had collected shiny pebbles, interesting leaves, sturdy twigs, and soft moss. They had studied how birds built nests and how spiders wove webs. They had even drawn dozens of pictures of what their dream treehouse might look like. But now that spring had arrived and building could finally begin, they discovered a problem. Let's make it super high, like a castle in the sky, Theo exclaimed, his eyes bright with excitement as he pointed to the uppermost branches of the old oak tree. We could see the whole forest from up there, maybe even the mountains beyond. Nina looked up, her whiskers twitching with concern. She shook her head firmly. No way. It should be low, close to the trunk, so it's safe. What if there's a storm? What if someone falls? What if... But if it's too low, it won't even feel like a treehouse, Theo interrupted. It'll just be a groundhouse that happens to be in a tree. Better safe than sorry, Nina replied, crossing her arms. And so began a day of disagreement. Each time one proposed an idea, the other rejected it. We should build it fast so we can enjoy it all summer, Theo argued. We should build it carefully so it lasts for years, Nina countered. We need big windows to see the view, insisted Theo. We need solid walls to keep out rain and wind, Nina responded. By sunset, they had made no progress at all. The pile of building materials sat untouched. Their carefully drawn plans remained just pictures on birch bark. Frustrated and tired, they sat on opposite sides of the tree, not speaking to each other. That's when Grandpa Sorin, the oldest and wisest squirrel in the forest, happened to pass by. He noticed the two glum faces and the untouched building supplies. I thought today was treehouse day, he said, settling down between them. What happened? Both squirrels started talking at once, each explaining why their own idea was right and their siblings was wrong. Grandpa Sorin listened patiently, his grey whiskers twitching thoughtfully. When they had finished, he was quiet for a moment. Then he asked, What if you're both right, in different ways? Nina and Theo blinked in surprise. But we can't build it high and low, Nina said. That's impossible, is it? Grandpa Sorin asked. When I look at this tree, I don't see just high and low. I see many different heights. What if the answer isn't choosing between your ideas, but finding a new idea that honours what's important to each of you? The siblings looked at each other, then back at the tree. For the first time, they began to see it differently, not as a battleground for their opposing views, but as a space with possibilities they hadn't imagined. What matters to you most about being high up? Grandpa Sorin asked Theo. The adventure, Theo replied immediately. The feeling of being up in the sky, seeing faraway things. And what matters most to you about being lower? He asked Nina. Being safe, she said. Not having to worry when the wind blows. Grandpa Sorin nodded. So the question isn't really high or low, it's how can we have both adventure and safety? As the last light of day filtered through the leaves, something shifted between the siblings. Instead of defending their positions, they began to ask new questions. Could they build halfway up the tree? Could they add features that would make it feel higher without being dangerous? The next morning, they began building with renewed energy. They chose a spot halfway up the oak, high enough to feel magical, as Theo wanted, but low enough to feel secure, as Nina needed. They designed a main platform nestled against the trunk, with sturdy supports underneath. But they didn't stop there. Theo added a rope swing that could launch brave squirrels, like himself, out into open air. Nina added strong railings around the edges and a roof that could shield them during storms. Together, they created a small telescope platform that extended higher into the branches, satisfying Theo's desire for height while including the safety features Nina valued. When the treehouse was finally complete, it wasn't what either had originally imagined. It wasn't just Theo's idea. It wasn't just Nina's. It was something new, something better, that had emerged because they had worked through their opposite views. What do you think? Nina asked Grandpa Sorin when he came to see the finished treehouse. The old squirrel climbed up carefully, inspected every corner, and then smiled. I think you've built more than a treehouse, he said. You've built a bridge between yes and no, between either and or. And those bridges are the most important kind. That night, as Nina and Theo sat in their new treehouse, watching the stars appear, Theo said quietly, I'm glad we didn't just do it my way. Me too, Nina agreed. This is better than what either of us thought of alone. Above them, the leaves rustled in a gentle breeze, not an either or sound, but a both, and whisper that seemed to say, this is how new things grow. Thinked together. Why did Nina and Theo get stuck in their argument about the treehouse? What made it hard for them to agree? How did Grandpa Soren help them see the problem differently? What question did he ask that changed their thinking? What made their final treehouse better than either of their original ideas? Can you think of a time when you and someone else disagreed, but you were both partly right? What happened? Why might it be helpful to look for what's important to someone else, even when you disagree with them? Do you think it's always possible to find a bridge between opposite ideas? When might it be harder? How does listening to different viewpoints help us learn and grow? Can you think of things that seem like opposites, but actually work well together? Like sweet and sour, work and play, or silence and sound, philosophy window, Hegel, and the dance of ideas. Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, pronounced Hegel, was a German philosopher who lived from 1770 to 1831. He had one of the most complicated minds in history. Even grown-ups sometimes find his ideas challenging. But at the heart of his complex thinking is a beautiful idea that even children can understand. Knowledge grows through a special kind of dance between opposite ideas. Hegel noticed something important about how we learn and how history develops. When people have an idea, let's call it idea A, eventually someone else comes along with an opposite idea, idea B. Instead of just picking one as right, Hegel suggested something revolutionary. Both ideas contain partial truths, and by working through their opposition, we can reach a new, bigger understanding, idea C. Hegel gave special names to these three steps in the dance of ideas. Thesis, the first idea or position, like Theo wanting a high treehouse. Antithesis, the opposite idea or position, like Nina wanting a low treehouse. Synthesis, the new, larger idea that emerges from the conflict between thesis and antithesis, their creative treehouse solution. This three-step pattern is often called Hegel's dialectic, from a Greek word meaning conversation. It's like a conversation between different viewpoints that leads to deeper understanding. What makes Hegel's approach special is that he didn't see conflict or disagreement as something bad that we should avoid. Instead, he saw it as a necessary and valuable part of how knowledge and societies develop. Each contradiction pushes us to think more deeply and create new solutions we couldn't have imagined before. Hegel applied this idea to everything from how individuals learn to how civilizations develop. He believed that human history itself follows this pattern. Movements arise, counter-movements oppose them, and eventually new social forms emerge that incorporate elements of both. For example, Hegel might look at the history of education and see thesis, traditional schools where teachers strictly control learning. Antithesis, complete freedom for children to learn whatever interests them. Synthesis, structured learning environments that also honour children's curiosity and choices. Importantly, Hegel didn't think this process ever really ends. Each synthesis becomes a new thesis, which eventually meets its own antithesis, creating an ongoing spiral of growth and development. This is why he saw truth not as something fixed that we discover once and for all, but as something that unfolds and develops through time. As Hegel wrote, the truth is the whole. By this he meant that to understand anything fully, We need to see how it connects to its opposite and how both are part of a larger, evolving picture. Your turn, idea builders. Materials needed, paper, colouring supplies, thinking partners. Just like Nina and Theo built a treehouse that combined their different ideas, you can practice being an idea builder who creates bridges between opposite viewpoints. Find a partner for this activity, a friend, sibling, classmate, or family member. If you're doing this on your own, you can imagine two different perspectives. Choose a topic that people might disagree about. It could be something like :should. Bedtime be early or late? Is it better to plan activities or be spontaneous? Should children choose their own clothes or have adults decide? Are rules more important or freedom more important? Is it better to work alone or in a group? Draw a line down the middle of your paper, creating two columns. In the first column, one person writes thesis at the top and completes the sentence, yes, because, giving at least three reasons for this position. In the second column, the other person writes antithesis at the top and completes the sentence, no, because, giving at least three reasons for the opposite position. Now for the Hegelian magic. At the bottom of the page, draw a bridge connecting the two columns. Above it, write synthesis. Together, try to create a new idea that includes the most important elements from both sides. Ask yourselves :what's valuable about each perspective? What's the deeper need or concern behind each position? How could we honour both sets of values? What solution might include elements of both views? Write or draw your bridge idea on the synthesis part of your paper. This isn't about compromise where everyone feels a little disappointed. It's about creating something new that's actually better than either original idea. Example, thesis, bedtime should be early because kids need sleep to grow healthy brains, parents need evening time to themselves, mornings are easier when everyone is well rested. Antithesis. Bedtime should be late because nights are when creativity happens. It feels unfair when adults stay up later. Some bodies naturally get tired later. Synthesis. What if bedtime had two parts? An earlier quiet time in bed with books and soft music, meeting the need for rest and giving parents some space that can extend later for those who aren't sleepy yet. Honouring different body rhythms and the special feeling of nighttime. Bonus challenge. Try this with a real disagreement you're having with someone. Instead of trying to win the argument, see if you can create a synthesis that honours what matters to both of you. Wonder more. Hegel believed that learning is like a journey through disagreement, questions, and surprising ideas. Unlike philosophers who thought wisdom came from finding simple, unchanging truths, Hegel embraced complexity and change. He saw that when we encounter ideas different from our own, even opposite to our own, we have an opportunity to grow. Think about Nina and Theo's treehouse again. If either squirrel had simply won the argument, their treehouse would have been missing something important. It was precisely the tension between their different priorities that pushed them to imagine something new and better. This is true in our own lives too. When we meet someone who sees the world differently than we do, we have three basic choices. We can ignore or dismiss their perspective, staying comfortable in our own view. We can abandon our perspective and adopt theirs. Or we can engage with the difference, really listen, really consider, and allow both perspectives to transform each other. The third path is Hegel's path. It's not always the easiest choice, but it's the one that leads to growth and discovery. Hegel's thinking also reminds us that truth isn't something that fits in neat little boxes. Real understanding often holds space for things that might seem contradictory at first glance. For instance, we might be both strong and vulnerable, both independent and connected, both certain and questioning. As you move through the world, you'll encounter many either or situations places where you feel you must choose between opposite options. When this happens, try asking Hegel's question, what if both perspectives hold a piece of truth? What new possibility might emerge if we look beyond either, or thinking? This doesn't mean all opinions are equally valid or that there's never a clear right answer, but it does mean that when thoughtful people disagree, there's often wisdom to be found on both sides, and even more wisdom waiting to be discovered in what lies beyond them. Question to carry with you, what's one time you grew by changing your mind or building a better idea with someone else? Patnacked, who do I choose to be? Inspired by Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre, pronounced Sartre, brings a bold and liberating message: you are free, and with that freedom comes responsibility. For kids, this can become a powerful story about choice, self-definition, and the idea that you get to decide who you become, even when it's scary. The Mask Room. In the middle of the city, on a street that curved like a question mark, stood a mysterious little shop. Unlike the bright, flashy stores around it, this one had a simple wooden sign that read, "The Mask Room." Most people walked right past it without noticing. But for anyone who looked closely, the small bell above the door seemed to ring just for them, inviting them inside. That's what happened to Lenny one Tuesday afternoon. She was walking home from school, lost in thought about the day's events, when the soft chime of the bell caught her attention. She looked up, saw the shop, and felt strangely drawn to enter. Inside, the mask room was larger than it appeared from outside. Shelves lined every wall, stretching from floor to ceiling, and on these shelves sat hundreds, no, thousands, of masks. There were masks for every type of person you could imagine, brave hero masks with determined expressions and flashing eyes, class clown masks with permanent smiles and rosy cheeks, smartest kid masks with serious, thoughtful brows, quiet mouse masks with soft features designed to help you blend in, even cooler than you masks with raised eyebrows and slightly bored expressions. There were sports star masks and perfect student masks, rebel masks and rule follower masks, good kid masks and troublemaker masks. As Lenny looked around in amazement, she noticed something else. Other children were in the shop too. They moved silently between the shelves, trying on different masks, examining themselves in mirrors placed throughout the room. A girl about Lenny's age slipped on a pretty princess mask and instantly stood straighter, tossing her hair in a practiced way. A boy tried a tough guy mask, immediately crossing his arms and leaning against a shelf with a scowl. "Hello there," said a cheerful voice. Lenny turned to see the shopkeeper, a tall person whose face seemed to shift subtly from moment to moment, never quite settling into one expression. "Are you looking for your mask?" they asked. "Everyone needs one, you know." I'm not sure," Lenny said, looking at the overwhelming selection. "There are so many. Well, what type of person are you?" the shopkeeper asked. "We have a mask for every kind of child." Lenny frowned slightly. "I don't know yet. Sometimes I feel brave, but other times I'm scared. Sometimes I'm funny, but other days I'm serious. Sometimes I want friends around me, but other times I like being alone." The shopkeeper nodded eagerly. "Ah, you need multiple masks then. Many customers take several. One for school, one for home, one for friends, one for adults. Pick the ones that fit who you are in different situations." Lenny walked slowly around the shop, picking up masks and putting them down again. She tried on a few special friends' masks, then a creative artist mask, then a good daughter mask. Each time, she studied her reflection. Each time, something didn't feel quite right. "Having trouble deciding?" the shopkeeper asked, appearing beside her again. "Perhaps this will help." They handed Lenny a mask labelled "Meet Expectations." "This is one of our most popular models. It helps you be exactly what others want you to be, Lenny held the mask in her hands. It was smooth and perfect, with a pleasant expression that no one could dislike. But something about it made her heart feel heavy. "What if," she said slowly, "what if I don't want to be a mask?" The shopkeeper looked startled. "Everyone wears a mask. It's how people know who you are, what you're like, where you fit." Lenny looked around the shop again. She noticed now that all the other children wore their chosen masks as they left the store. They seemed confident in their new identities, but also somehow fixed, as if they'd made a decision they couldn't unmake. "Thank you," Lenny said politely, handing the meet expectations mask back to the shopkeeper. "But I think I'll try something different." And she walked out of the mask room with no mask at all. Outside, the world seemed brighter somehow. But as Lenny continued her walk home, she noticed people staring. Some looked confused, others uncomfortable. "What are you supposed to be?" asked a boy from her school, tapping the skateboard expert mask he wore. Lenny hesitated. Without a mask, what was she? Who was she? Then, slowly, she smiled. "I guess I get to decide, and maybe it can be different things on different days." The boy looked puzzled, but Lenny continued walking, feeling strangely lighter than before. That day, she chose to be kind, helping her little brother with his homework, even though she'd planned to read her new book. The next day, she chose to be curious, asking questions in class that made her teacher pause and think. Some days she felt scared, like when she had to give a presentation in front of the whole school. But instead of hiding behind a confident speaker mask, she simply acknowledged her fear and spoke anyway, her voice sometimes shaking, but her words her own. As weeks passed, Lenny noticed something interesting. While the masked children always acted the same way, always fitting the identity they'd chosen, Lenny could be different things at different times. When she felt angry, she could express it without being labelled the angry kid forever. When she made a mistake, she could learn from it without becoming the failure. One afternoon, as Lenny walked past the mask room again, she glanced in the window and saw the shopkeeper helping a new customer. For just a moment, their eyes met. The shopkeeper looked surprised to see her, then curious, then, just possibly, a little impressed. Lenny waved and continued on her way, wondering who she might choose to be tomorrow. Think together. Why do you think Lenny decided not to pick a mask like everyone else? What was she looking for instead? In the story, what did the masks represent? Why do you think people were comfortable wearing them? What does it mean to choose who you are instead of letting others define you? Do you think we always have a choice in how we act and who we become? What might limit our choices? Have you ever felt pressure to fit into a certain mask or role? How did it make you feel? Is it scary to define yourself through your own choices instead of following labels others give you? Why or why not? Lenny noticed she could be different things on different days. Does this mean she wasn't being her true self? What would you choose to be today if you didn't have to fit anyone's idea of who you are? Philosophy Window, Sartre and the Power to Choose. Jean-Paul Sartre, pronounced Sartre, was a French philosopher who lived from 1905 to 1980. He spent much of his life in Paris, where he could often be found writing for hours in cafes, smoking his pipe, and discussing big ideas with friends and fellow thinkers. Sartre developed a philosophy called existentialism, which explores what it means to exist as a human being. His ideas emerged partly from living through difficult times, including World War II, when his country was occupied by Nazis and many people had to make hard choices about who they would be under terrible circumstances. At the heart of Sartre's philosophy is a powerful idea. Human beings are fundamentally free in a way nothing else is. Unlike a tree, which simply grows according to its nature, or a cat, which acts on instinct, Humans have the unique ability to choose who they will become. Sartre expressed this idea in a famous phrase, "Existence precedes essence." In simpler terms, this means we exist first as blank slates, and only afterward create our essence or nature through the choices we make. We are not born with a predetermined purpose or fixed identity. We create ourselves through our actions and decisions. This freedom can feel overwhelming. Sartre acknowledged that it often leads to a feeling he called anguish, the dizzying awareness that you alone are responsible for who you become, with no rulebook to follow. He wrote that humans are condemned to be free, meaning we can't escape the responsibility of choice, even if we want to. Sartre noticed that many people try to hide from this freedom through what he called bad faith. This happens when we pretend we have no choices. I had to do it. I had no choice. Or when we define ourselves solely through roles or labels, I'm just doing what a student daughter athlete is supposed to do. In the story, the masks represent this kind of bad faith, fixed identities that relieve us from the challenge of choosing who to be. But Sartre believed that authentic living means embracing our freedom and accepting responsibility for our choices. He famously said, "You are what you do, not what you say you are." Our essence isn't found in labels or intentions, but in our actions, the concrete choices we make each day. Importantly, Sartre didn't think this freedom meant we should be selfish. In fact, he believed that when we choose, we're not just choosing for ourselves, we're suggesting a vision of what any human being might choose. As he put it, when we choose for ourselves, we are choosing for all humanity. Your turn. Today, I choose. Materials needed, paper, colouring supplies, thoughtfulness. Sartre believed that we create ourselves through our choices every day. Each decision, no matter how small, is part of the ongoing project of defining who we are. Let's explore this idea with a simple but powerful activity. At the top of your paper, write, "Today I choose to be someone who..." Complete this sentence in a way that feels meaningful to you. It doesn't have to be something dramatic or extraordinary. It might be something like, listens carefully when others speak, stands up for what's right, even when it's difficult, tries new things, even when I might fail, expresses how I really feel instead of what others expect, takes care of the world around me, asks questions instead of pretending to know, helps someone who needs it, creates something that didn't exist before. Now draw a small comic strip, 3 to 4 panels, showing yourself making this choice in a specific situation. For example, if you chose listens carefully, you might draw yourself putting away distractions and turning toward a friend who's speaking, asking thoughtful questions and remembering what they shared. Below your comic, reflect on, how does making this choice help define who you are? What might have been easier to do instead? How might this choice affect others around you? If you want, create a small collection of these choice statements that feel especially meaningful to you. You could keep them in a notebook or on cards, not as rigid rules, but as reminders of the person you're choosing to become. Bonus activity, at the end of the day, take a few moments to notice what choices you actually made. Were there moments when you lived up to the person you wanted to be? Were there times when you made different choices? Remember that for Sartre, the point isn't perfect consistency, but honest awareness of your freedom and responsibility. Wonder more. Sartre believed we become ourselves through our choices, not just the big, dramatic ones, but the small, everyday decisions that add up over time. Like choosing ingredients for a recipe, each action we take contributes to the person we're creating. This idea can feel both liberating and overwhelming. If you're not defined by labels others give you, if you're not limited to being the person you were yesterday, then who are you? The existentialist answer, You are your choices, continuously unfolding. Think about Lenny in the story. By walking out of the mask room without a mask, she wasn't refusing to be anyone. She was claiming the freedom to be many things, to evolve, to surprise herself with who she might become. There's something both exciting and a little scary about this view of life. It means your past doesn't have to determine your future. It means mistakes don't have to define you forever. It means you can always begin again, choosing differently today than you did before. Of course, our freedom isn't absolute. We can't choose our starting circumstances, where we're born, our families, our natural abilities, the historical moment we live in. But Sartre would say that even with these limits, we always have some freedom in how we respond to our situation. As you go through your days, you might start noticing moments of choice you didn't see before. The moment between feeling angry and deciding how to express it. The space between wanting something and choosing whether to take it. The pause between hearing an unkind comment and deciding how to react. These small moments are where your freedom lives. They're where you create yourself, choice by choice, day by day. So, if you could become anyone through what you do, through the accumulated choices of your days, who would you choose to be today? Not forever, not perfectly, but in this moment, with the freedom you have right now? Question to carry with you. If your identity isn't fixed or given to you, but created through your choices, what kind of person are you choosing to become today? Sestnak, the questions you carry. A farewell from the philosophers. Dear philosopher in training, you've travelled quite a journey through these pages, haven't you? You've wandered through ancient Greece with Diogenes, puzzled over contradictions with Hegel, explored the nature of existence with Sartre, and contemplated happiness with Epicurus. Along the way, you've met some wise, wild, and wonderfully weird thinkers through the characters in our stories. Nico and his book of maybes taught you that not knowing can be the beginning of wisdom, and that questions are sometimes more valuable than answers. Montaigne, Luma the Badger, showed you how to find meaning by continuing to push your boulder, even when life doesn't make sense. She reminded you that joy can be an act of rebellion against absurdity. Camus, Dio the dog barked at pretense and showed you that you don't need much to be happy, just honesty, simplicity, and perhaps a good nap in the sun. Diogenes, May and her shared chopstick demonstrated how tiny acts of kindness and respect can ripple outward, building harmony within a community. Confucius, Theo and Nina helped you see that opposites can work together to create something new and better, and that disagreement can be the beginning of deeper understanding. Hegel, Luna the raccoon, revealed that the parts of ourselves we try to hide are still important pieces of who we are, and that becoming whole means accepting all of ourselves. Jung, Milo discovered that while we can't control everything that happens, we always have power over how we respond. Marcus Aurelius, Lenny reminded you that you don't need to wear a mask to be real. You are free to choose who you become through your actions. Sartre, Elio the squirrel showed the difference between rushing through life and truly being present for it. Heidegger, Remy and his umbrella taught you that everyone experiences the world differently, and that listening deeply is the beginning of understanding. R&D, Laying. Solly the Firebird dared to sing her true song, reminding us all that authenticity takes courage but lights the way for others. Nietzsche. Nico the Fox crossed his bridge despite his fear, showing that our most meaningful choices often require a leap of faith. Kierkegaard. Tilly and her apples revealed that sometimes the simplest pleasures are the most profound, and that we might already have everything we need for happiness. Epicurus, these characters and their stories have lit up big ideas with small, brave moments of clarity. They've whispered ancient wisdom in ways your heart could hear and your mind could explore. But now it's your turn. Philosophy isn't about memorizing what others have thought or having all the answers. It's about developing your own relationship with wisdom, asking great questions, and living your way into discoveries that matter to you. The word philosophy comes from Greek words meaning love of wisdom. To be a philosopher is simply to be a person who loves wondering, questioning, and searching for deeper understanding. The very best questions are the kind you carry with you, the ones that walk beside you as you grow, revealing new layers of meaning as you experience more of life. What matters to me, really? Not what should matter or what others say matters, but what truly resonates in your own heart. Who do I want to be and why? What kind of person do you hope to become through your choices and actions? How can I live kindly, bravely, and honestly? What does it mean to live with integrity toward yourself and care toward others? What do I do when life gets confusing or hard? How do you find your way when the path isn't clear? Is it okay to change my mind? How do we balance conviction with openness to new understanding? How are we all connected? What responsibilities do we have toward each other and the world we share? Can I help others understand their questions too? How might your wondering create space for others to wonder alongside you? These questions don't have final answers. They have conversations, explorations, and moments of insight that unfold throughout a lifetime. Sometimes they'll feel clear as a bell, and other times they'll tangle into knots of confusion. Both experiences are part of the philosophical journey. Philosopher's Toolkit, you already have it. The good news is that you don't need a fancy robe, a long beard, or an ancient scroll to be a philosopher. You don't need special equipment or advanced training. Everything required for philosophical thinking already lives within you. Curiosity, the willingness to ask why and what if. And how do we know? Courage, the bravery to question what everyone takes for granted and to sit with uncertainty. Kindness, the heart to wonder not just for yourself, but for the good of others too. Attention, the ability to notice what others might miss, both inside yourself and in the world. A little quiet, some space and time to listen to your own thoughts. A little noise, conversations where ideas can bounce, combine, and transform. Wonder, that special feeling when something ordinary suddenly seems extraordinary. And the freedom to begin again, because philosophy isn't about being right the first time, it's about being willing to keep thinking, even after making mistakes. These tools are with you everywhere you go. When you're walking to school, lying in bed at night, sitting with friends, or noticing something strange or beautiful that makes you pause. Final activity, my Brave Mind Map. Before we say goodbye, let's create something to help you remember this journey and continue it in your own way. Materials needed, a blank page, colouring supplies, your thinking mind. Find a blank page that feels special to you. In the center, write or draw, I think about big things. Around this center, create a constellation of your philosophical explorations. A question that fascinates me. Write down a question from this book that really made you think. Or one of your own questions that keeps you wondering. A story that moved me. Note which character or story from the book resonated most with you and why it mattered. An idea that changed me. Describe a philosophical concept that shifted how you see yourself or the world. A philosopher I'd like to talk with. Which thinker would you want to have lunch with if you could? What would you ask them? Something new I'm wondering about. What fresh question has started growing in your mind that wasn't there before? Decorate your mind map in a way that feels like you, with colors, symbols, doodles, or patterns. Find a special place to keep your map, maybe in your favorite book, on your wall, or somewhere private just for you. Most importantly, revisit this map as you grow. Add new questions, cross out old ones, draw connections between ideas. The map will grow and change as you do. Philosophy isn't finished when you close a book. It continues in how you see the world tomorrow, how you ask better questions next month, and how you might understand these same ideas completely differently years from now. Farewell letter from the book. Dear brave mind, you've thought big thoughts. You've felt deep feelings. You've wondered wide wonderings. No one else in the history of the world will think quite like you do. That's not just interesting. It's important. Your unique way of seeing and questioning is a gift that only you can offer. Some days, thinking big might feel overwhelming. Some questions might seem too heavy or too tangled. That's okay. Philosophy isn't always comfortable. The most worthwhile explorations rarely are. When that happens, be gentle with yourself. Set the question aside for a while. Look at clouds. Eat a cookie. Talk with a friend. The questions will wait for you. And remember, the world doesn't need people with perfect answers. It needs honest thinkers with brave hearts and curious minds. It needs people who can listen to different perspectives, who can change and grow, who can hold complexity without giving up. It needs you. Keep questioning. Keep wondering. Keep noticing what others miss. Stay curious. Stay kind. Stay you. Until the next big question arises. Your friends in philosophy. P.S. The philosophers in this book would want you to know something important. They didn't always agree with each other. They argued. They changed their minds. They made mistakes. That's not failure. That's philosophy happening. So don't worry about getting everything right. Just keep the conversation going, both with others and within yourself.